We'll call the Environmental Natural Resource Conference Committee between the Senate and the House together to order, rather, excuse me. And members, what we're going to do is we're going to start in right away. As the agenda says, you've got a copy of your agenda. And we're going to continue through the walkthrough of the side-by, and hopefully we can get some progress here. So we'll start out with Mr. Mueller. Continue to where you're at, please, and let us know where you're at, and we'll start in.
Mr. Chairman and members, I believe we're on the spreadsheet. We're on page 4. We finished last time with the DNR budget, and we're starting now with the smaller agencies, starting with Metro Parks on top of page 4. The Senate has a 15% cut, which is a little over $1 million for the general fund. The House is a little bit higher at $1.4 million general fund cut. The Senate also increased the appropriation out of the lottery in lieu account by $300,000 per year, and the House did not incorporate that. Next, we have the Minnesota Conservation Corps. The Senate eliminates the general fund portion of their funding, which is $455,000 per year. It's a little bit less than half of their overall state funding. The House does a smaller, about half that reduction over the biennium, but they do it $155,000 the first year and $300,000 then after that. So that leaves about half the general fund money Conservation Corps under the House budget. The next agency on line 239 is the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The Senate reductions, the Senate took sort of a across the board 5-6% reduction on most of the grant programs and about a 15% reduction on sort of administrative costs and other costs that were and then where the governor maybe had a higher reduction, the Senate and the House took most of those. You'll see on lines 248 through 252 on most of the grants, the House has a larger reductions on most of those grant programs. Then on some of the cost share, then there's a couple of proposals where the governor's budget had proposed eliminating some pass-through funding on lines 255, 256, and 257. The House has picked up one of those reductions with the Red River Basin Board, and the Senate does not. And then the other two boards, there's no reductions in the House or the Senate on line 256, 257. Then on lines 258 through the end, 262, both the House and the Senate have the same level of reductions for Bowsers. Overall, the Senate reduction, general fund reduction to Bowsers, 9.7%, $2.7 million. The House is at just under $4.9 million for Bowser. The last one here is on page 5, Minnesota Zoo. The Senate has on line 284, a 15% general fund reduction, and that's $1.8 million. The House is less than that at $1.2 million. Both the House and the Senate are showing extra special revenue fund spending that would result. The governor was showing this money also on line 286. This was the zoo was showing that they would be spending extra fee revenue that they would collect in this biennium. So that's what the money on line 286 is. At the end of page 5, the bottom part of page 5, you'll see there's a general fund summary for each agency. And We'll see the Senate, the overall reduction in this environment area on line 32 when you count the revenue changes. On line 320, I mean, when you count the revenue changes and the reduction is a minus $36 million net general fund reduction, which is 15% compared to the base. The House is at $44.215 million net general fund reduction in this environment portion of the budget. The next lines, 322 through 326, is sort of a summary of the general fund revenue changes in the bill, and these we all covered when we went through the different portions by each agency, but you'll see the Senate's got a minus 5.257 general fund reduction, and the House has a 10.395, and that's mostly because that includes the shift of the fee revenue, the water fee revenue that would usually go into the general fund moving over to the environmental fund. So there really is no real net loss of revenue on the House side. That 10.395 is just a revenue shift. The Senate, again, has some new general fund revenues coming in on lines 323, which is moving half of the penalties that are paid to the environmental fund, moving half of that over into the general fund. And then also on 326 is the Senate provision where we selling the state nurseries would net the general fund $3.6 million. The last part of page 5 are just the summaries of other revenue changes that we covered as we went through each part of the agencies. I'll skip over that for now. On to page 6, we have the spreadsheet that shows the budgets for the Department of Commerce and then later on the Public Utilities Commission. This one's structured a little bit differently than the previous one. So the first part, lines 9 through 23, is sort of the summary level totals for the agency. You'll see on line 12, the general fund total for the Senate is a net reduction of $582,000, and the House has a net general fund reduction of $3.182 million, so a difference of $2.6 million between the two bills. The first change item under Commerce is on line 31, financial institutions. The Senate actually increases general fund funding for financial institutions by $350,000 per year. This amount gets assessed back, so this amount is recaptured. This new spending through financial institution is also recaptured in revenue, because for the most part, this part of the Department of Commerce, all their costs are assessed back into the general fund. So this is to pay for three new FTEs under financial institutions on the Senate side. The next change item is within the petroleum tank cleanup portion of the Department of Commerce, just on lines 47 and 48. This is carried both on the House and the Senate side. This was also in the governor's bill. This extends the petroleum tank cleanup fund that was set to sunset after fiscal year 12. So and money from this fund actually goes to PCA, Commerce, and to deed. So this portion of the fund that goes to Commerce is being shown on line 47 to 48. So this would be increased spending over the base. The next change items we have are the Division of Administrative Services within the Department of Commerce. Both the House and the Senate on line 62 have a general fund reduction. The Senate has a $1.9 million general fund reduction in this area, and the House has a $1.2 million reduction. The Senate also has a provision on line 63 where we add some additional FTEs in their unclaimed property portion of the Department of Commerce, and this generates some increased compliance in this part of the Department of Commerce, and this actually generates revenue that we'll see later in the bill. This generates about $3 million, this $750,000 on line 63 for the biennium generates about $3 million of new revenue in the unclaimed property portion of the Department of Commerce. Next difference is on the next page, page 7, the market assurance portion of the Department of Commerce. The lines 81 through 83 are all reductions that were proposed in the governor's bill, in the governor's budget, and those are being carried on both the House and the Senate. And then the House has an additional reduction on line 84 of $1.3 million over and beyond the cuts proposed by the governor, just within the Division of Market Assurance. There's no changes to the Division of Telecommunications. And last, we have the Office of Energy Security within the Department of Commerce. That division starts on line 107. The Senate has a change item on line 117 of this was also proposed in the governor's budget, an increase of $265,000 per year for some additional FTEs and to help with their processing of regulatory proposals. Again, this was part of the governor's bill, and this amount actually gets assessed back and is counted again in general fund revenues. So there's no net general fund cost, or it is just general fund cost, but there's no net general fund change with this. It's increased cost and an increased assessment on the revenue side. And the House did not have this proposal. That is the only change within the Office of Energy Security. The last one on page 8, this is the Department of Commerce Telecommunication Access Minnesota. Both the House and the Senate have some new one-time appropriations on lines 136 through 138 dealing with some one-time appropriation coming out of the TAM fund. There's a little bit different ways that the House and the Senate are sort of tracking some of the base appropriations within this portion of the bill, and that's something we'll have to work out later. But generally, the House and the Senate are the same on this portion of the Department of Commerce's budget. The last part of Commerce is weights and measures. That's all a special revenue-funded portion of the department, and there's no changes to that portion of the department. Last, we have Public Utilities Commission. The House has no change to the base funding for the PUC. The Senate did adopt the governor's proposal for $750,000 per year, again, for some additional FTEs to help quicken up the decision-making that goes on there at the Public Utilities Commission. And that $750,000 per year, again, is assessed back to the general fund, so the net effect on the general fund is zero with the PUC changes here. That's it for the expenditure side. On page 9 is just a quick summary of the net changes between the House and the Senate. We'll get down to the revenues and the transfers are a little bit lower, but you'll see on line 194, or first on line 192, the Senate has $35.77 million of mostly one-time revenues coming in through transfers for this portion of the budget. And the House has $18 million. The details of these transfers are below that on on lines 199 and down. The first one is on line 202, the assigned risk plan. The Senate has sort of two transfers, one each in fiscal year 12 and 13, at roughly about $11.3 million in each year. And the House has a one-time transfer of $15 million out of the assigned risk plan. The Senate on line 203 has a transfer out of the telephone assistance program account, the TAP fund, of $1 million. The House has no transfer from that one. On line 204 is the TAM account, or the Telecommunication Access Minnesota account. The Senate has a one-time transfer of $1.1 million. The House has $250,000 transfer. Now the next ones on line 205 down to 211 are all cancellations of portions of appropriations that originally came out of the Renewable Development Fund in previous bienniums where these appropriations were made. And basically the way these appropriations work, if they go unspent, there's nothing really that they automatically get canceled back to. So any unspent money from these appropriations are sort of just there, and they don't automatically cancel back. So the Senate's canceling all these leftover amounts from previous appropriations back, or transferring them, canceling them, and then transferring them to the general fund. So those are all lines 205 to 211, and those are not in the House bill. Line 212, the House has a $300,000 transfer from the Special Revenue Fund for Energy Conservation Improvement account. The Senate does not have this transfer, but it does have some language in the bill directing a certain portion of that account to be spent on a specific purpose, and we'll get to that when we go through the language. The last ones transfers here are both in the House and the Senate bills, just mostly for different amounts. The line 213 is a licensed technology surcharge account. House Senate has $650,000 transfer. The House $250,000. Insurance fraud prevention account is the next one. The Senate has $950,000. The House has $500,000. Auto theft prevention account. Both the House and the Senate have a $1.5 million transfer out of that account. And then the real estate research and recovery account. The Senate has a $450,000 transfer, and the House has a $200,000 transfer. So again, the total transfers on the Senate side is just over $30 million, 30.044, and the House has $18 million worth of one-time transfers. Then on line 218 through 223 are other revenues that appear on the Senate side in the commerce or the energy portion of their budget. And most of these are assessments back to the general fund for dealing with new employees. 219 is the assessment for the new employees at the PUC. Line 220 is the assessments for the new employees in the Office of Energy at the Department of Commerce. Line 221 is the assessment for new FTEs for new financial examiners in that portion of the Department of Commerce. And then line 222 is the increased revenue that would be realized from the new FTEs for unclaimed property. And the Senate has $3 million there for the 12-13 biennium, and then some ongoing revenue in 14 and 15 of $2.4 million. So the Senate has a total of $5.7 million in other revenues. And then, so the total general fund revenue on the Senate side, dealing with just commerce and energy, is 35.774, and the House, again, is at $18 million. So that is it for that portion of the bill. I think we'll have Jim go through the, unless there's any other questions, we'll have Mr. Reinholtz go through some of the differences in the LCCMR article of the bill.
Members, any questions so far? Hearing none, Mr. Reinholtz, would you walk us through the LCC?
Mr. Chairman, members of the conference committee, then I'll begin on what's numbered page 10, and once again, I'll speak to the differences. I may look for help from Mr. Mueller on Senate-only programs that I'm not familiar with. The first one where there is a difference, and these are not numbered, but you can see there is a column in which you're going to see the title, the differences from the Senate, differences from the House. It shows those two columns you can follow, and that's where you'll see where we're different. The first one is the Minnesota Breeding Bird Atlas, Phase 3. The House has zero funding for that. The Senate has funding of $142,000 for that. The next difference is the next item, below that, the Golden Eagle Survey. The House has $90,000 appropriated for that. The Senate has no dollars appropriated for that. Moving down, one, two, three, four items on down the page, there's a change in resiliency in boreal forests in northern Minnesota project. In that case, the House has $200,000 appropriated for that. The Senate has no dollars. Moving on to page 11, the first item is the first item on the page. That would be the St. Croix Basin Conservation Planning and Protection Project. In this case, the House has $0. The Senate has $120,000 for that item. Next item in the lands, habitat, and recreation areas, the Lake Vermilion State Park development. House has $3 million. Senate has none. The next item is state park and recreation area operations. House has no dollars. The Senate has $3 million. Next item down, state parks and trails land acquisitions. House has 3.566. The Senate has 3 million. So the House is 566,000 more than the Senate is on that item. Move down to the scientific and natural area, the acquisition and restoration. The House has 1,824,000. The Senate has 3,280,000. Mm-hmm. So the difference there, the Senate is over the House by 1,456,000. Next item down where there's a difference is the LaSalle Lake State Recreation Area acquisition. In that case, the House has 2,374,000, which is 374,000 more than the Senate appropriation of $2 million. Next difference is right below that is the Minnesota River Valley Green Corridor SNN area acquisition. In this case, the House has 2,374,000, which is 374,000 more than the Senate again. Moving down, the Metropolitan Conservation Corridors, Phase 6, in this case, the House has 3,530,000. The Senate has $3,475,000. The difference there is the $55,000. Moving on to page 12, the Habitat Conservation Partnership Program. In this instance, the House has 56,000 more. The House has 3,531,000, and the Senate has $3,475,000. You have to move on to page 13 then for the next. Actually, that's just totals. There's no program differences on 13. I think page 14, the first project on page 14, the Emerald Ash Borer Landscape Management, the program. In this case, the House has zero funding for that. The Senate has $229,000. Next item of difference is down in the emerging issues area, in the aquatic invasive species item. In this instance, the DNR, the funding for that is $5,626,000, in the Senate $5,640,000. So there's a slight difference there. The House Senate has $14,000 more than the Senate. In the PBS documentary, the House has on aquatic invasives. The House has no funding. Senate has $100,000. The last item on the page, the program, the accelerated land sales and exchanges. The House has $200,000 for that. The Senate does not have funding for that. Moving on to page 15, two last differences. The first one is the administrative funding for the LCCMR. The House has $946,000 over the biennium, the $912,000 in the Senate, so the House is $34,000 more. Contract administration for the DNR, the House has $200,000, Senate has $220,000, so the Senate is $20,000 more than the House. That, members, is the differences in the programs in the Environmental Trust Fund appropriations.
Members, any questions?
Mine or yours?
Hearing none, we'll move into the larger packet that you have here, the side-by. And I think the intention is to, at this point, to start going through that, and we'll turn it over to Mr. Knopf. And I don't know, should we do questions at the end, or how we want to do it?
Mr. Chair, I think you can take questions along the way if that's
okay.
Makes sense to me.
If you see my
Ms. Taylor, I think, will help me walk through.
Okay. And you'll let me know when you want to switch over.
Yeah.
And if you have any questions, members, if I have my head down, please either throw something at me or make some noise. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I think we can skip the first two pages, kind of boilerplate, and we won't really look at numbers here. You looked at those on the spreadsheet. We're just going to go over language. On page R3, you have a House-only provision on 2.28 to 3.7. I think Ms. Taylor, you want to describe the House position?
Mr. Chair and members, the rider he's speaking of, it's a rider we've carried in the past. It requires grant recipients to post their outcomes on the website or provide those to the PCA to post those on their website. And then we can go ahead and skip the numbers on the bottom of page R3. And then there's a House-only rider for water program operations, and this was reflected in the spreadsheet. The next rider, 3.18 through 3.24, there's some minor differences. The numbers are different, and then the Senate has a carve-out of $150,000 of one-time money from the Environmental Fund. Again, the next rider are identical except for another carve-out on the Senate side of $48,000 for administration of individual septic tank fees on the Senate side.
And
the riders on the bottom of page.
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't mind interrupting. The $48,000, the rider on the Senate side is the same rider we've carried for a couple of biennials now. So, four biennials.
On the bottom of page R4, the rider there's just one small difference. The Senate includes for Clean Water Partnership on lines 4.23, and this is because the House does not have the Clean Water Partnership program. And then there's some Senate-only riders.
And, Mr. Chair, we got to the first one on 3.7 to 3.16. That is the Clean Water Partnership program. The House does not have that rider. I think it's shown in the spreadsheet. I think they were zeroed out in the House. We also have the SST administration grants. That's 3.17 to 3.24, including $68,000 each year for assistance to counties. And then we also have a rider for assessment and monitoring of lakes and rivers and streams on 3.34 to 3.36. This was done 2 years ago because that was a base amount that the agency was using. And one of the reasons to flag it was to make sure that they would continue to use that so we wouldn't get involved in substituting legacy money for that purpose. And then on the bottom of this, on 4.13 to 4.19, we've got money for the water management study required. Now that's on page R123. It's from a Peterson bill, Senate file 196. That's the water management study you'll see later in the side by side. And then, Mr. Chair, we can move on to page R6. And we have two Senate-based riders that are not in the House side. One is for the Small Business Environmental Improvement Loan Account, and another one is for the Environmental Fund for monitoring ambient air for hazardous pollutants in the metropolitan area. The House does not include those. Those have been base riders that we've been carrying for a while. And then when you get to the, I think we can go all the way through to the bottom page, R7, and you have a house only.
Mr. Chair, members, the rider is on lines 5.15 through 5.21, and this is some money for the biomonitoring project on PFCs. It's completion of that program. And then we can move on. There's some minor technical differences on the riders on page R8. And then on the bottom of R8 on line 6.11, you'll see that the fund is different for that rider. The House has the environmental fund, whereas it's the general fund on the Senate side as reflected in the spreadsheet. And then you can move on. The next difference is on page R9. There's a Senate-only rider.
And, Mr. Chair, members, the Senate rider is the $800,000 for the cost of implementing the general operating permits for feedlots. We have a provision you'll see later in the bill. Dealing with exempting feedlots that don't give off water at all or any type of waste into waterways, that they will not discharge is the word I was looking for, that don't discharge, they would be able to receive a separate state permit and not get the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit. And this is to pay for that. There was a fiscal note on this, and this is the rider that provides money for it. And then, Mr. Chair, we have on the remediation fund, we have the two different riders here. The House allows the agency to transfer as much money as they want between the environmental fund and the remediation fund. The Senate, similar to what was done 2 years ago, caps that. Mr. Mueller went through that on the spreadsheet, but this is the $42,000 limitation that's in the Senate side. 2 years ago, the limit was $40 million. And then, Mr. Chair, I don't think we need to talk about anything on page R10 or R11. But when we get over to page R12, we have on the Senate side, on the first rider, on 9.1 to 9.3, the Senate allows unencumbered balances in the first year to not cancel and available in the second year. Generally, for grants, they don't allow that carry forward unless you put the language in the law appropriating the money. And then we also have riders for the mining administration account. Money to cover the land and water crossing and road easements for the licenses. This is money that's recovered by the people applying for the easements. And then and these are base riders from 2 years ago. And then also in 920 to 932, there is money appropriated in the House side from the state forest suspense account, but they don't have a rider that spells out what the money is going to be used for. Again, this was in the bill 2 years ago, and the Senate just continues to have these riders in place. And then, Mr. Chair, I think on page R13, there's a slight technical on the House refers to a subdivision on 9.2, and as far as I know, that's the only difference on that page, unless somebody wants to correct me. And then, Mr. Chair, on page R14, we have some Senate-only riders. This does reflect the difference in spending. And when Mr. Mueller was going through the spreadsheet, we've got $1 million a year from the Heritage Enhancement Account for law enforcement and water access inspection to prevent aquatic invasive species. We have the money for the Headwaters Board, including the money to the Leech Lake Band of Chippewa Indians on the top of page R15. And Mr. Chair, I think we can move on to page R16. There is one difference in the rider in the middle there, 12.22 to 12.29 on the Senate, 10.22 to 10.27. This spells out what part of the appropriation from the forest management investment account is one time. Mr. Mueller went through and Mr. Reynolds went through the spreadsheet. That there is a difference in that the Senate, this increased money out of the forest management investment account, would be one time because there are some concerns about the long term, what this would do to the long term nature of the fund, and the balance, and then. Mr. Chair, on page R16, the House has a rider on 10.32 to 10.34. That's different.
And as you saw in the spreadsheet, this is the House's reduction in the forest system program. And then you can move on to R17, and at the top of that, there's a Senate-only rider.
And, Mr. Chair, that was, again, in the spreadsheet. This is the money from the ATV account for them to maintain minimum maintenance forest roads. And then we can go back to the House on the rider.
And then on lines 11.7 through 11.15, the House has a rider that would require divisions within the DNR to sort of reimburse the Division of Forestry for their time spent on sustainable resource management plan work. And then we can move on to the top of page R18. There is a House-only rider, and this is an appropriation from the Water Rec account for aquatic invasive species. And then there's a Senate-only rider.
And, Mr. Chair, this is a base rider dealing with enhancing public water access facilities from the Water Recreation account on 1316 to 1319. And then you'll see a Senate-only rider in the bottom. You can ignore 13.29 to 14.2. It actually is doubling up of the rider that's on 14.23 to 14.29. That was just a mistake. It was placed in there twice. One was, I think, taken from this year from the governor's bill, and one was taken from last year's or the bill 2 years ago. So that just that was just an error in putting the bill together. And then, Mr. Chair, members, we have on page, you can move to page R19 then, and then there is an additional sentence. I think it's technical. I think the additional sentence on the Senate side probably doesn't need to be there on that first rider. Otherwise, and then on the bottom of the page.
I'm sorry, Mr. Knott, which numbers were they?
It was 14.3 to 14.11. If there's a sentence on 14.7 to 14.9, this additional money may be used for new grant and aid trails. That was left over from the rider, I think, 2 years ago when there was additional money put in. This is now a base amount. And that sentence doesn't need to be there. The House appropriately took that sentence out. And then, Mr. Chair, we've got a couple of riders that are the same. And then in the bottom, you have the House appropriating money from the damage account for all-terrain vehicle grants and aid, whereas the Senate just transfers the money from the ATV damage account to the natural resources, to the ATV account in the Natural Resources Fund. And Mr. Chair, we can move on to page R20, and the top rider is just some technical differences between the House and the Senate. Also, I think we use general fund and they use natural resources fund money for that. And then we have a House-only rider on 1313.
And as you saw in the spreadsheet, this is some money the House had for an ATV trail plan and some trail building. And then there's a Senate-only rider.
And, Mr. Chair, this is the East Grand Forks rider for the Red River State Recreation Area. We had a bill on this in committee to provide a small amount of funding to the city of East Grand Forks for their operations and their duties with regard to that recreation area. And we have a rider on R20 from the House.
And this is a House-only rider that would prohibit the DNR from closing any state park or state rec area in the next biennium that is funded with an appropriation in this bill.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask a question about
Certainly.
That?
Certainly, Mr. Knopf.
When Commissioner Landwehr testified, we talked about mothballing state parks. Does closing include mothballing?
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Knopf, we did not define, it was a Representative Hackbart amendment, and we did not get into it any further than just what is said here, that we didn't have any discussion about reductions, it was, or how we would define close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was curious in reading the language. And, Mr. Chair, I think we can skip over R21. It's pretty much the same. And then on R22, there's some technical differences in the second rider on each that we can take care of. And then the House has a House-only rider.
And this is lines 14.31 and 14.32. This is some money for acquisition. I believe this is the Lamprey project. And then there's some Senate-only riders.
Mr. Chair, I think we have the money in for that, but just don't have the rider. Mr. Chair, we'll see a number of riders now on the Senate side that the House does not include, and it's basically because the House went along with the governor's recommendation to make all of the stamp and surcharge accounts statutory appropriations rather than direct appropriations. So the Senate's carrying the base riders that we've carried, I think, since 95. That we've had for these accounts to make sure that they're spent appropriately. So you've got you can go from 16.1 down to 17.20, I think, are all the stamp and surcharge accounts. And then we also have a Let's Go Fishing from the Heritage Enhancement Account. That's the lottery in lieu money. We have a $200,000 appropriation that they went through in the spreadsheet is the rider on the bottom and includes a report and work program. And then, Mr. Chair, we get over to the to R24, and I think the only differences are the House has some additional language at the bottom of page R24.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, there's also, if you look at the rider above the last rider, the House establishes a base for that appropriation, and then the rider on 15.18 through 15.22, this is some one-time money for a Conservation Officer Academy. And then moving on to page R25, there's some differences in the rider on the bottom for the ATV safety and environmental education grants. The House has some language requiring a report and also allows the money to be available in the second year. And again, on the top of R26, the only difference between the top two riders is some additional language on the House side allowing the appropriation to be available in the next year. And then there's nothing to mention on the next ones. Moving on to page R28, there's some minor wording differences on the rider on the House side, starting on 18.25 through 18.33, and then you'll see sort of two riders that correspond to the House riders on the Senate side, 21.21 through 21.35. And the House does allow some feedlot water quality projects. I believe that's the substantial difference there. On page R29, the differences here are mostly technical until you get to lines 19.23 through 19.26 compared to the Senate side, 23.3 through 23.6. The Senate has some language allowing the administration of programs to be covered by the appropriation, and then there's a Senate-only rider at the bottom of page R29.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Ms. Taylor mentioned, in their rider on the previous page in R28, there was some language allowing it for feedlot water quality projects, which they actually are allowed to be. Cost sharing can be used for that. That's one of the things that can be used for. And then the Senate has a carve-out, though, of $433,000 each year for feedlot water quality grants to make sure that it can only be spent on those activities. And then, Mr. Chair, we can go over to page R30. The Senate also includes a rider for the Minnesota River Board. I thought when we were going through the spreadsheet that the House had money for that, but I'm not sure. And that's again been a base rider for a number of years, and then that the last rider under Bowser, which is the same, is basically just allowing them some flexibility in how they spend the money. For the Met Council, there's no language to talk about. I know there are money differences, but there's no language. Conservation Corps, again, money differences, but no language. Same with the Zoo Board, and then I think Mr. Chair, if somebody wants to go through the Energy, Finance, and Commerce, this is something that I'm not very familiar with. So I prefer if other staff people would go through that.
Mr. Eloff, is that correct?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think we need to discuss anything on pages R33 or R34, mostly numbers. The first language differences we come to, this is on page R35 at the top on the Senate side, lines 94.31 through 33 are not in the House language. On the House side, the riders on line 22.13 through 16 are not in the Senate. I'm bumping down to the Senate again, $350,000 on line 95.1 is not contained in the House language. And at the bottom of that page, under Subdivision 4 Administrative Services, 95.8 through 95.18 is language that's not contained in the House language. That continues on the top of page R36 another Senate rider that's not in-house language. At the bottom of page R36, that transfer language is slightly different in that the Senate on lines 99.6 and 7 adds that to the commission base. That language is not contained in the House version. There's also some different language on the Senate side on page R37, lines 99.13 to 15, which specifies that the money to the Office of Enterprise Technology is for coordinating technology accessibility and usability. That language is not contained in the House version. Moving now to the top, to page R38, we've got certainly differences in numbers in just about all of these riders. On the House side, lines 24.1 to 24.3 for telecommunications Access Minnesota Fund is different from the Senate language. Differences down that page until and on page R39, the all that language is Senate only, not in the House language at all, and that continues to through page R40. At the bottom of page R40 is some language referring to the community energy or the clean energy resource teams that is in the Senate language at the bottom of the page, but is not in the House language. And on the top of page R41 is some House language referring to cooperative electric associations that's not contained in the Senate version at all, which is also true of the remainder of page R41, what's referred to as Article 3 on the House side, which continues on page R42. And again, we pick up similar language at the bottom of page R42, which continues back into environmental.
Mr. Chair, we're going to start going through the environment and natural resources statutory language. I'm on the bottom of R42, Section 2 and Section 19 on the Senate side are identical. This is having to do with the state park revenue deposits. Again, on R43, Sections 3 and Section 23 are the same. This is regarding the forest management investment account. Sections 4 on the House side, 25 on the Senate side. These are for having to do with forest campground fees. And if you remember when we were going through this spreadsheet, there were a number of statutory appropriations that the House had that the Senate did not. And this is one of the differences you'll see on 27.17. This is the language that enacts that. So that's the only difference there. Again, with Sections 5 and Section 28, again, the only difference is on 27.22, another statutory appropriation on the House side. Moving on to page R44, Sections 6 on the House, 29 on the Senate. Again, we have another statutory appropriation for some certified forestry costs. And then Sections 7 and 8 are House-only sections, and if you remember when we were going through the riders, these are the statutory appropriations the House established for the various license fee and stamp fee accounts. So you can move on to the bottom of page 47, Section 9 on the House, Section 39 on the Senate side. There's some minor differences. There's a little bit broader use on the Senate side for this new account that established for the water fees that you may remember when we were going through the spreadsheet. Section 10 and Section 40.
Excuse me, Mr. Knopf, do you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, can I just mention what's going on here? There was some language that was sent over pretty late by the agency to update their original language, and I think the House is carrying the original language. We updated it on the Senate side because there's a field inspection fee that's not included on the House side, and what this is intended to do is broaden it to include the field inspection fees and also to include basically just administering all of Chapter 103G as a purpose of the account. And then you can see on the bottom of page R49, I guess some other differences. We've got the deposit of fees as a separate subdivision, and it includes all of those that are collected in that section, whereas the house has the fees deposited only from the that subdivision. So it, the Senate's just broader. It's more of the fees are going into this new water account. And I think it's actually technically more correct with the $5 million per year. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, on page R50, we can move ahead till there. There's a house only section 12. This is regarding the aquatic plant management permit fees, and this would kind of revert the statute back to where it was before the change was made that started the rulemaking process that has been going on for the last couple of years. On the bottom of R50, sections 13 and 44 regarding the e-waste program are identical. The same on the bottom of R52, this is more e-waste language. Sections 14 and 45 are identical. And then sections 15 and section 5 on R54, this regarding the petrol fund eligibility, and they are identical. Moving on, R55, the extension of the petrol fund that we saw in the spreadsheet, section 16 and 6, these are identical. Section 17 and section 51, this is another section on the peace officer training, and again, the only difference is the statutory appropriation on the House side. You'll see that on lines 39.17 to 39.18. And then on R56, these are the sections having to do with the Waldorf sulfate standard. There's some differences. The major one would be that the House is establishing a 50-milligram sulfate standard, whereas the Senate is suspending application of the standard, and you'll see that on the bottom of R57. And there's other differences as well, but that's the major difference. And then on page R58, on the top of that, you'll see the repealers. The both the House and Senate have the repeal of 84.02 definitions regarding native prairie, and then there's a number of additional Senate repealers.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, what you'll see is the Senate is carrying the same repealing of the prairie and grassland definition language, but the Senate also includes on 85.013, that's the Blakely State Wayside. That was in Senate File 692, Senator Hall's bill. All the sections dealing with 89.06 to 89.31, that's the tree nursery bill. That was Senator Peterson. That's repealing the language for the state operating tree nurseries. 97B.511 is the moose stand height. 515 is the elk stand height. And then the remaining provisions there in 116G.15, that's the Mississippi River critical area, and that's the that was part of Senator Cruz's bill, Senate File 39. So those are the additional repeals on the Senate side. And, Mr. Chair, we can probably go quickly through LCCMR here. You're going to see a number of Senate-only provisions at the end here. They really belong up in here, but the revisor placed them because they were just so many of the Senate-only provisions. They were put at the end. So what we'll do here is go quickly through LCCMR stuff. You went through on the spreadsheet. If you look on page R61, you can see the two different programs that were funded in both the House and the Senate. And you'll see some house only on R62 and R64. You see a Senate only. And you'll see the difference in R65, where the House spends the money on Lake Vermilion and the Senate on park and recreation operations. And then one difference I wanted to point out in the language is if on R66, and we don't think we need to do this every time, but if you look at State Parks and Trails land acquisition, wherever the House has the same language for the acquisition, the House has moved additional money in to set aside money in a trust fund land management account. That will be, you'll see that later in the bill. And so that's basically, I don't know if the House wants to explain that anymore, but that's a basic difference in a number of these land acquisition provisions in here. And then Mr. Chair, I think we can continue on. You'll see the same language on page R68 for another land acquisition for, and then you'll see the ones for LaSalle Lake and R69. You have that. And then there's some slight wording difference on the head note on 51.29 in the house and 67.32, the Green Corridor Scientific Financial Area acquisition. And then, again, you'll see that same language on R70 with regard to setting aside money in that land management account. And then same thing on page R73. You have at the top of that, you've got some money there, too. Now, there is a little difference in the language on page R72. The house on the number of the easements says, if you look on 55.2 to 55.4, it says, and a fund established for monitoring and enforcing the agreement as provided in subdivision 17. On the Senate side, it says money appropriated from the trust fund for easement may be used to establish a monitoring. If you look on 70.23 and so on, an approved work program, an annual financing report is required for the monitoring management enforcement fund. So there's some different language on how that's phrased in each side. And again, on the bottom page, R73, you've got that house provision on the land management account. And then also the same language difference is on 57.6 to 57.8 in the House and 72.23 to 72.30 on the Senate. So those are just slight differences in how they deal with the monitoring and enforcement account in the House and Senate. And then, Mr. Chair, I think we can just keep going here. We're at R78, 79, unless there's something that somebody flags that I haven't noticed. And R81, again, we have an Emerald Ash Borer provision on the Senate side that's not on the House side. And then, Mr. Chair, we also have on page R83, both sides appropriate money for wild rice standards. The one difference is the House says it's available until June 30th, 2015. On the Senate side, I think the money would be available until June 30th, 2013. So that's a little difference on the extent of what the money is available for. And then, Mr. Chair, they went up through the money differences, but you can see on page R84, we have a carve-out of $100,000 on line 81.9 of $100,000 for a grant to Minnesota Public Television to develop and produce a documentary. It should be available to DNR. So that's an addition on the Senate side. And then the Coon Rapids Dam, on the House side, it's a grant to the Three Rivers Park District for the pre-design and design. For the Senate, it's to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to do the design or to hire out for the design. And then we have a House-only provision on 65.23.
Mr. Chair, members, this is $200,000 that you saw when Mr. Reinholz was going through the spreadsheet for the DNR 2 for some accelerated land sales and exchange planning. And then moving on page R85, there's some money difference, but if you look at the contract management rider, you'll see the money difference, but also on the House side, the money goes directly to the Commissioner of Natural Resources, whereas on the Senate side, it goes to the LCCMR. And then moving on to, you can kind of skip ahead. This is all identical language, unless I'm missed something. There's some minor differences on R91 that reflect a change you'll see statutorily later on the House side. If you look at 72.25, the House says must be specified in, and if you look at the corresponding language on the Senate side, 88.19 be approved as part of. The House eliminates the requirement that work programs be approved by the LCCMR, and you'll see that language. And there's some other minor differences in the language that reflect that change. Move forward. There's some minor technical differences I don't think are worth mentioning. And then we can move along to page R98. There's a House-only Section 3. What this does is recodify the Federal Land and Water Conservation Funds. There's a LACON statute, and this has to do with on the House side, the LCCMR's responsibility for making recommendations for a portion of those funds is removed. So this is just codifying this in the DNR statutes rather than the LCCMR statutes. Section 4 on the bottom of R98, moving to the top of R99, this is the land management account that was mentioned when we were going through the spreadsheet, and this is where all those appropriations for land management would go into. Section 5, this is the section in the LCCMR statute that removes the LACON responsibility and the work program approval requirement. Page R100, Section 6, and then also Section 7. This removes the requirement of the LCCMR to approve the non-game wildlife checkoff work programs. And then on Section 8 on R101, these are some repealers related to the LACON, and there's also another repealer of a requirement in the LCCMR statutes that they approve any use of unclassified employees. And then there's a Senate-only section.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to announce Section 9 you can completely ignore. That was already enacted. It's in Chapter 14, 2011. It was in the agriculture bill. So Section 9, you don't need to deal with at all. That goes all the way through 25.11. And then Section 10, this is a DNR recommendation for exchanges. This, again, was from Senate File 692, Senator Hall. Section 11 deals with the management plan as a technical change. It also was in Senate File 692. Section 12 was a governor's recommendation. It was in the governor's budget. Now, the one difference is, though, is that in the Senate, the fiscal notes basically said 4% of the money was going to be used out in the future. So this actually ties it to 4% of the balance. In the governor's language, they were going to open up all of the money in the account to be used for this, that be annually appropriated to the commissioner. And this just limits it to the 4%. Section 13 is the off-road vehicle state trail pass. That was in Senate File 567. Senator Miller carried that in the Senate. Section 14 was, again, another one from Senator Hall dealing in Senate File 692. Dealing with the ATV training, and that was again recommended by the administration. Section 15 is, you would have seen that in the spreadsheet, but it's the 2 years ago, the legislature decided to transfer $725,000 over each year over a 2 year period, but then it would end. What the Senate does is continue it and increase it to $1 million. This is a transfer from the water recreation account to the invasive species account. And the way the Senate has worded this, it would be ongoing. It'd be $1 million per year transferred from the water recreation account to the invasive species account. Section 16, motor vehicle trails restricted against it. Again, that's from Senate File 692, Senator Hall. So is Section 17. Section 18, that's just that we're reducing the amount for the trail grants to a 25% local match. Section 20 was from Senator Sparks, Senate File 43. That's adding the Cedar River. Section 21 and 22 are dealing with watercross. That's from Senate File 692. Both of those are Senator Hall's bill. That was a department technical bill. The next section here, 24, if you look on the top of page 108. This is clarifying that money transferred from other accounts to the Forest Management Investment Account is in the receipts, and I'm not sure. This was in the governor's budget. The House has all the other components of this, but not this part. I don't think it's an essential part, but it is a clarifying language on that. Section 26 is from Senator Hall's bill, Senate File 692, so is 27. They deal with the Mineral Mining Coordinating Committee. Section 30 was an amendment in committee on the Citizen Oversight Committees in Senate File 692. Senate Hall, this was kind of reforms them into kind of makes it a more manageable oversight process. Section 31 on the Senate side on page R110, that's from Senate File 678, Senator Gazelka, dealing with the preference for those that received a Purple Heart or has a service-connected disability rated at 100%. Adding that to the preference. And then Section 32, deer killed by motor vehicles, that was a Senator Bach provision, Senate File 442, clarifying that the driver of the motor vehicle can keep the deer as long as it was not taken illegally. Section 33, that puts scopes on muzzleloaders. That was from Senator Saxhog's bill, Senate File 259. I should say it allows scopes on muzzleloaders. But, Section 34, this is the deer stand restrictions. Again, in the repealers, we went over the elk and the moose, and this would remove the deer stand restrictions and the height of those. And this is from Senate File 438, Senator Bach. Section 35 was from Senate File 58, Senator Kubley. It deals with portable deer stands, allowing them to be erected on a WMA the day before and left unattended through the night as long as it was going to be used the next day. Section 36, this is another Senator Bach provision, Senate File 443. This deals with what to do with the leftover when people don't purchase the permit. It also requires them to purchase it earlier on the bear permit. Then it gives preference to those for 1 week to those who have applied unsuccessfully, and then it opens them up for counter purchases after that time. Section 37, that was a Senate File 358, Senator Ingebrigtsen, and that deals with removal of beaver dams by road authority. Section 38 is the Northern Pike Experimental and Special Management Waters. That was in Senate File 213, Senator Ingebrigtsen again. This limits them to 90. I think they're a little over 120 right now. And then the enforcement funding, Mr. Mueller went through the spreadsheet. The Senate in Section 42 has proposed that one half of the money from civil penalties and paid under stipulation or settlement agreements be put into the general fund and half to the environmental fund. And so that was also reflected in the spreadsheet and the appropriation on the Senate side. Section 43 you can ignore. Again, that's already law, or variation of it. That's in Chapter 14 of 2011 laws. Section 46, we mentioned this earlier on the rider with the money for this. This would eliminate the requirement of an NPDES feedlot permit as long as the feedlots don't discharge, which is basically with the way the federal rule reads now. And so what it does is so it eliminates a lot, and there's a lot of other cleanup language in there. That's some obsolete language that's not needed anymore, but you can see on starting at 46.6 through 46.30, it's basically requiring the agency to issue a general operation permit for those feedlots over 1,000 animal units that do not need to have a national pollutant discharge elimination system permit. And that's what the $400,000 per year of the environmental fund was for. Again, a lot of cleanup language at the bottom of page R115. We don't need to go over that. That's very fairly technical. Section 47 was also, and these were in Senate File 42 as it went to the Finance Committee, but were dropped, which is also House File 1. They were dropped in Finance Committee because of the cost implications, and they were moved into the budget bill instead. And then that's an animal unit determination. That's basically telling the PCA that they look at the number of animals that they're having at the facility rather than the number that the maximum capacity that could be used or could be taken care of at the facility. The next section, Section 48, that's from Senator Rosen, Senate File 435. And what this does is exempt an ethanol plant that it's expanding from a mandatory environmental assessment worksheet. It only exempts them from the mandatory. If they are required to, meeting other thresholds, they would still have to do an EAW, but this is just from the mandatory one. Now, I know there's been a lot of discussion. I think the House has this in another bill. There are there's also an issue with some new ones that have arisen over biobutanol facilities and whether they should be included or not. I've had conversations with Senator Magnus and Senator Rosen about this, and I don't know, if it's going to be resolved here. There are a couple of other things that need to be done that go along with it. There was also a repeal of the definition in the Ag Bill this year, and both this provision and a current law provision rely on those definitions that were repealed. And so I think we're going to need to undo just one subdivision from that repeal of the ethanol program this year for these things to work properly. Fortunately, the repeal was put out for 2 years, but I think we can take care of this. More technical, but I want to make sure that the conference was aware that there may be some additional language needed with regard to this. And then, Mr. Chair, we can get over to Section 49 on page R119. And you have the Mississippi River National River and Recreation Area. That again, we had the repealers from Senator Cruz's bill. This is the statutory. This is one provision where basically deleting the language that was added 2 years ago. Section 50, that was from Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill on the it was Senate File 675. dealing with making DNR part of the cyber system, the enforcement division. Section 52 expands the use of silencers for law enforcement, for wildlife control purposes. That was also in Senate File 675, Senator Ingebrigtsen. You can see the language on page or R120. You see the delay, the date is eliminated for the trial on this, and then also some other limitations are stricken on 52.32 to 52.35. And then in Section 53 is the Coon Rapids Dam Commission. Again, both sides have money in the LCCMR for the Coon Rapids Dam. This just reestablishes a commission. There was one that sunsetted from last year, and this would reestablish it with slightly different purposes going ahead. Section 54, this is from Senator Peterson's Senate File 161. It deals with working out with Wisconsin over the phosphorus standards that are going to be used for Lake Pepin. Section 55 is the Terry McGaughey Memorial Bridge. That was Senator Gazelka's bill, Senate File 304. And it basically tells the DNR to name the bridge on the Paul Bunyan Trail for that person. Then the Mississippi River Management Plan, that's dealing with the village of Dayton, allowing them to conform with the wild and scenic river rules of the state. Senate File 333 apparently has caused some problems for the city and some of their development, their historic downtown. Section 57 deals with rulemaking. That's again Senator Cruz from dealing with the Mississippi River critical area. And what that does is it clarifies that their authority for those rules is void and must cease any rulemaking. Section 58 is from Senator Carlson's bill. It basically tells the Commissioner of Natural Resources to eliminate the spearing ban on Cass Lake, Senator Carlson's bill. Senate File 364 is the next section. Section 59, that was Senator Peterson's bill. This again deals with a state tree nursery closure. We saw some of the repealers already for that. Section 60, another Senator Peterson provision on water rulemaking moratorium. It's from Senate File 196. And you can see there are a number of exceptions that are placed starting on 55.26. Section 61 is an evaluation. That was again from Senator Peterson's bill, Senate File 196. The Commissioner of Administration evaluating state and local water-related programs, policies, and permits. And Mr. Chair, I think that takes us to the end of the side-by-side.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Any questions from the committee members? It's all clear. Very good. Next on the agenda, we're going to move into some public testimony on energy, on the energy section. Mr. Haar, is that right? Public Utilities Commission. Mr. Haar, welcome to the committee.
Chair, thank you. Members, my name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission. I mainly wanted to make myself available if there were questions on our proposal, our change item. That's the main purpose of my being here.
That's easy enough. Members, any questions? Representative?
It's Director Haar, isn't it? Is it Director? Excuse me. Again, is it Director Haar?
Executive Secretary, sir.
Mr. Secretary Haar, in regards to the PUC, we had some new employees, and we had some discussion in committee. I believe, is it a total of 10 new employees that you were looking for?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the proposal, the change item would include 7 employees, and that would also allow us to retain 3 employees that we have currently on staff, but the funding for which will end at the end of this year. So it would be actually an increment of 4 additional over what we have now.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Haar? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we'll move into the Commerce section testifiers. Mr. Palumbo, Anoka County Attorney, and after that, Dave. You've got names like me, Picha.
Not here. Neither one's here.
Neither one is here. Mr. Palumbo, nobody's here? Okay. We'll move into the You have a question?
No, I don't.
Members, we'll move into the public testimony and environmental section now. Mr. Brent, from the Minnesota Timber Producers. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Our members are loggers, paper mills, sawmills, truckers, producers of renewable forest-based biomass, and landowners. I do have a handout, one graph here.
Certainly, we can get that to you.
Thank you. A couple of things that we'd like to talk about. We certainly understand how difficult the budget situation is. We are heavily dependent on public timber here in the state, particularly state timber, about 800,000 cords. No, this is the handout. I think they already have the spreadsheets. Thank you. About 800,000 cords out of about 2.6, 2.7 million that are harvested every year come from the DNR. It's our understanding at the start of this year that there were approximately 100 field vacancies in the Division of Forestry that had occurred over the preceding years. We are deeply concerned that the ability of the Department of the Division of Forestry to manage state lands and harvest timber is teetering on the brink. As of March 31st, DNR had sold approximately half of the, and that's through three quarters of the fiscal year, had sold a little less than half of the 800,000 cords that they had planned. We've been tracking that statistic for 10 years on a quarterly-by-quarterly basis. That's the lowest level of accomplishment through three-quarters of the fiscal year that we've seen in the decade that we've been tracking it. So we think it's at a very serious situation and has the potential to have very significant impacts on our sector of the economy. One item that is in the House side that was mentioned in the side-by-side, the rider language dealing with reimbursing the Division of Forestry after SFRMP, after their management plans have been approved by the commissioner, has the ability to free up some field staff time. You know, we understand from field staff that they spend about 20% of their time responding to inquiries from other divisions after the SFRMPs have been signed by the commissioner. So we appreciate the House including that in the bill. I believe that was a committee amendment and maybe a floor amendment, and would ask the Senate to give that strong consideration as a way of freeing up some staff time. Sustainable Forest Resources Act, Minnesota Forest Resources Council, I would just point out that those are nearly similar in the governor's proposal in the two bills at $560,000, $580,000 a year. That's half of what the that program used to have 6 or 7 years ago. So that's been substantially cut and is at the bone. Finally, we would strongly urge the committee to not permanently close the two nurseries for the state forest system. I won't belabor that. I believe I've testified in front of both committees on that at some length. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I thank you for your time and consideration. The chart that I passed out, the graph that I passed out, the bars on it show wood usage by the industry in the state. The green line shows harvest in the state. You'll see that there's was a shortfall for a number of years. In other words, supply and demand in our state were well out of balance. We were importing a lot of expensive wood from beyond our borders. That and other circumstances drove the red line stumpage prices through the ceiling. At that time, we had the highest stumpage prices of any where in the world, and that led to the permanent closure of four large plants, which represented one-third of the wood consumption in the entire state. So we ask your deference and consideration and sympathize with the challenge you have with the budget. Thank you.
Mr. Brown, if I could you give me a little guess as to what you folks are thinking about the future here? Are you seeing things? Are you looking out into the future here at all of support, you know, demanding more lumber? I mean, where are you at? I mean, what are you hearing?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, since the closures of those four plants, demand has been relatively flat here in the state. Usage for both paper, engineered wood, lumber, and biomass for energy have been flat. There's the last new pulp mill that was constructed in the United States was the then Potlatch, now Sappy pulp mill in Cloquet, Minnesota, which started up about 11 years ago. There's not been another new pulp mill. There really hasn't been any new paper mill construction in North America. There have been a lot of closures. On the building product side, both lumber and oriented strand board, with the housing crisis that new home construction cratered in the summer of 2006. You'll see that's part of what drove some of those plant closings. We had amongst the higher cost mills. Housing starts, new housing starts, which drive OSB and lumber, went from 2 million units a year down under 600,000. They remain under 600,000 with the mortgage problems and the other financial issues. We don't see housing starts rebounding new home construction this year. We don't see it being significant next year. It will take several years before we see the opportunity for growth.
Just a point of interest, the most recent tornadoes in the southern part of our country, does that make a big difference for Minnesota wood production?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one of the dirty little secrets of our business is that natural disasters are good for our business. You know, as painful as it is for everybody involved, it does, you know, require a lot of wood, a lot of panel products to rebuild those areas. Even before the tsunami in Japan, we were seeing substantial movements out of North America of lumber and also raw logs off of the West Coast going to the Asian market, and that we believe will only accelerate. That does help us a little bit, keeps the West Coast lumber from coming into our market, and is also, along with the stronger Canadian dollar, has served to keep Canadian lumber out of our market more so than it used to be.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Brandt, we have some conference committee members here that haven't heard some of your testimony about the Senate's proposal to close the DNR tree nurseries. I'm wondering if you could just quickly go over your concerns very quickly in regards to the research, the seed collection, and if you could specifically talk about your concern for availability of plant material for reforestation.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, three basic issues on the nursery. One, the state nurseries provide bare root stock used primarily to plant on state, county lands and also distributed to private landowners, sold to private landowners primarily through soil and water conservation districts throughout the state. The state nurseries are the only producers of bare root stock in the state. They also produce a broad range of species of different native grown trees. We don't buy from, the industry doesn't buy from state nurseries. We believe that they are an important part of the mix for providing seedling planting stock to landowners, both public and private. We are unconvinced that the private sector will get into the bare root business. Private sector nurseries produce containerized seedling stock. So you know, we are concerned on an absolute supply basis for the trees, seedlings, their availability. Second, the DNR at those facilities, particularly at Bedora, the Bedora Nursery, coordinates, it gathers up seed stock for growing the seedlings from throughout the state for all of the species that they grow. We don't believe that that function is well suited to the private sector, given the very dispersed nature of doing that. I mean, literally, private citizens go out and pick up jack pine cones and bring them in bushel baskets to DNR buildings and offices, and then the DNR buys them from them. And that's a substantial part of how the seeds are collected. So that's an important function. They also sell a fair amount of those seeds to the private nurseries for the private nurseries' use. So that is significant. And then finally, the Tree Improvement Cooperative is housed, and the work for that done is done at the state nurseries. And that's a public-private partnership that has been key to strengthening our planting stock through research and development, particularly developing white pine blister resistant white pine seedlings and other products. So, you know, we think that they've, you know, but the nurseries form an important part of the whole mix for the state.
Mr. Brandt, I just want to clarify, you said the private sector is not in the bare root business. I don't know that you really meant to say that, but that's clearly not a true fact. The private sector industry is substantially larger than the DNR part of the industry. I'm not sure what you meant by what you said.
Bare root stock that's provided to the DNR and to the counties is the primary market, primarily what the state nurseries provide.
Correct.
Sorry if I misspoke.
I just wanted to clarify.
I would never want to get in an argument about nurseries with a nurseryman.
Well, Mr. Brand, I just wanted to clarify that I think your concerns, if I could summarize them, and I think I'll do it after Senator Peterson. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brandt, do you think that these nurseries should operate in the black or at least break even?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, absolutely. And we have so conveyed in the strongest of possible terms to the department and to the Division of Forestry. We do not believe that those nurseries should be running at a loss on an ongoing basis as they have for the last several years. And we have strongly urged the department to come forward to the committees, to this conference committee, with a plan as to how they are going to have the nurseries be in the black.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Brandt, when did you first express that opinion to the operators of the nursery?
Mr. Brandt.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, several years ago when they started dipping into the red. I mean, we monitor the annual nursery reports to the legislature. I believe if you look back 3 years ago, 4 years ago, they had about $2 million in the nursery account. I think it's been even higher different times in the past. And they clearly need to do something. They need to run them on a break-even basis. I'm not sure how you break even when you're running two nurseries at 30% capacity, which is round numbers kind of what they've been doing.
Senator Peterson.
Why do you think they haven't been responding to that advice?
Mr. Brandt.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, I guess I would just put it on the list of some of the advice we give them that they don't respond to. I'm not sure why they haven't responded to it. I mean, it seems like a no-brainer for an agency that's in an enterprise that they should be doing that.
Senator Peterson.
So you think it's the main reason why they haven't been making in money is their capacity or breaking even? Is it their capacity?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, you know, I'm not an expert on the business of running a nursery, but it seems to me on face value when you're growing 6 million seedlings, I think has been their production the last couple of years, and your capacity is about 10 million or so at each of the nurseries, that it doesn't make a lot of sense to be running two of them at 30%. I mean, it's just got to be more efficient to run one of them at 60% than two of them at 30%.
Thank you. Mr. Brand, I just wanted to summarize some of the things you talked about so that we are on the same page. I think the research part is very important to the state, to the forestry industry, to the nursery industry. The seed collection, originally you said it was important that the DNR be doing that, but then at the end of your testimony, you clarified that actually it's the private sector that's doing that work in coordination with the DNR, and I think it's an important part that seems to be working quite well. That is the kind of cooperation we should have, a private sector working to do some of the work, DNR playing an important role. And I see you nodding with that. You did acknowledge that there is a significant bare root business within the industry currently, and your concern, I think our concern, and many folks is that we have availability of especially the evergreen seedlings that the DNR nursery are producing, that they continue to be available, and we work to find a solution to the way that they would be available for the members of the committee that aren't on one of the committees that heard the testimony. As you talked about, the forest nursery account, I believe, currently has about $1 million in it. The receivables that the forest nursery have are substantially lower than they've been. They're on a path that doesn't work, and there's also current state law that does not allow them to go on the path they're going. So we have some challenges before us. State law requires them to break even, something they haven't been doing in recent years. So we look forward to working with your industry to find a solution to this issue. But things have got to change big time because this is a business, and we need to have it operated by business folks in a business manner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We certainly agree with that sentiment.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. And then I think we'll continue down on the list. Next, I have why don't we do is Mr. Fitch in the audience? I thought I saw him, but maybe from the Nursery and Landscape Association. If we're on this issue, Mr. Fitch, is he not here?
Not yet.
Okay, then we're going to move on.
Here he is,
Mr. Fitcher. Oh, he is here. Okay. If you could come forward, Mr. Fitch, identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Fitch. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, representing the nursery and landscape companies throughout Minnesota. With your permission, I would just clarify a couple of things that Mr. Brandt said. There are private sector bare root producers in this state. I think our good friends Schumacher's Nursery and Berry Farm would be very surprised to hear that there's no bare root nursery since they've been in it for several generations, as have other producers in the state. Our folks, our growers collect, get their seed, buy their seed from the same folks that the DNR buys their seed from. And so there's really that's a false issue in our minds. And obviously we are extremely frustrated with the fact that the state requires the DNR to operate in the black, and they've failed to do so the last 2 years. And they have don't have a plan for turning that around in the foreseeable future.
Thank you. Questions for Director Fitch? Thank you, Mr. Fitch. I know Mr. Meyer and Deputy Commissioner Shad are here. Mr. Meyer, did you want to testify or Deputy Commissioner in any of this? I don't know if it's necessary, but if we're on this topic, if you are interested in addressing some of these concerns at this time.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, with me is Deputy Commissioner Shad. And we were in and out of the room dealing with another conference committee that's going on at this point in time. But I think I understand the crux of the discussions that occurred. And, Mr. Chair, I know you have seen our most recent annual report on the nurseries. And I believe in that document it outlines the path we are going down. We do realize it's important to continue this work, but we also realize the fiscal requirements that we have in place to maintain the nurseries with a fiscal credibility. I don't think the law actually says they have to operate with a profit every year, but we understand the intent of that language. We also believe, and I know in the conversations we've had, Mr. Chair, it's important to maintain the state's involvement in this industry to guarantee our ability to provide seedlings for our reforestation work and make sure that there are enough seedlings around to do all the reforestation work that we need and conservation work that we have. But we do recognize the need to right-size our organization, and the report outlines that, I think, very clearly. I will provide committees for that report for the conferees here. I'll provide you a link or a PDF if you wish to see that, or I can get you a hard copy as well. But to sell them within the Senate position to outright close down and liquidate the assets, clearly we do not support that, Mr. Chairman, but we also understand what we need to do, and we are doing what we need to maintain our operation and to also support and enhance our work with the private community as well, the Nursery Association.
Well, thank you, Mr. Meyer, and I have looked over the new report and have gotten a financial document that I think it's MMB puts out, and it shows a plan, and I'm trying to interpolate from what I can see there. We are in what I would assume is probably the beginning of the planting season, potentially, or very close to it if you haven't already started. Are you replanting at General Andrews Nursery this spring? Are you planting new plantings at General Andrews Nursery this spring?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Dave Shad, Deputy Commissioner. My understanding is we are, but at a very low level, in part because we feel like we do need some contingency if we get a disease issue or something like that at our primary production facility, which is Bedora. We need some redundancy in order to assure that we will have planting stock 2 to 3 years down the line when the trees that are planted this year will be ready for harvest and planting on our state forest lands.
Deputy Commissioner Shad, are you planting stock that's either 2 or 3 year stock in General Andrews? Now, I'm disappointed to hear that you're planting in General Andrews. Are you planning maybe just 1 year stock that is going to be harvested next year? Are you on a plan to still be in General Andrews 2 years from now? Three years? I should say, I'll go back to my original question. Are you planting stock that has more than a 1 year life in General Andrews now?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not absolutely certain about that. I do know, as Mr. Meyer testified, we are looking at a smaller operation here. We're looking at the economics of what that looks like. We have identified Bedora as the primary facility, and we're going through the analysis to see if we can do it all there, or if we need to keep some small level of production at Willow River, either to ensure that we've got adequate planting stock for public land planting, or again for this redundancy function to make sure that we do have a backup in place in case something catastrophic happens up at Bedora. But we're taking a close look at whether or not and what the future of that secondary facility at Willow River looks like.
Well, Deputy Commissioner, do you have a plan to meet state law and on the cash flow analysis from MMB, it shows you going in the red and the red and the red. It doesn't look to me like you're meeting state law. I'm disappointed to hear that you're going to keep planting, as Mr. Brandt said, and I believe he was very generous in the percentage of capacity that you're operating at. I don't understand why you wouldn't be working with the private sector in working towards a transition that seems to make more sense and concentrate on your own evergreen production, which is where you should be centered when you have so much private sector availability for the other things. And I don't agree with the need for two locations based on your need to break even. Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, you're right. We have lost money. We're required by law over time to break even within that operation. Obviously, the poor economy here has affected our private sale of trees, which is a relatively minor part of what we do. We also haven't had a lot of conservation funding available, especially at the federal level, through the Farm Bill for tree planting programs, and we haven't had a lot of landowner interest in tree planting programs on private land. So all of that in combination has resulted in, over the last 3 years, we've lost money. That is why we're doing this business analysis. That is why we're taking a much closer look. You know, Commissioner Landwehr and I have been on the job for about 3 months. We've been a very steep learning curve on this whole nursery issue, and we're committed to figuring this out and making sure that we adhere to the law.
Thank you. I would say I would like you to get back to the committee on your reforestation plans. I have not seen them direct, and maybe I've missed them. Maybe they're in a document. I'm not aware of that, but I would like to see that. I'm disappointed to hear that you're planting at General Andrews. I would hope that you would be working more in a direction that we could try and work on this together. The Senate has a plan that I think is too aggressive. I don't think that it's, and I don't mean this with any disrespect, Senator Peterson, their idea, and I don't blame them for their frustration, actually, after listening and, like, you know, but I don't want to have it on Senator Engelbretson and my shoulders that we didn't make sure that Mr. Brandt's got the trees to harvest in years to come because of a short-sightedness by the environment folks right now. So I look forward to you working with us, and this is an important issue, and I respect the fact that you're taking it serious. You have some good people there that can help you work on this issue, and we need to do it in double time. Additional questions for the testifiers? Is there anybody else specifically in the audience that wants to speak to this issue? We're going to move back to the next person on the list. Mr. Clavin, on behalf of the turkey growers. Okay, I got you both there. Good. Mr. Sohnfeld, you might as well just come together. Two for one. We're moving along. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent the Minnesota Turkey Growers, the Broiler and Egg Association, and some others. I know there's a collective groan in the room here when Jerry and I get up, because everybody knows it's about feedlots. We'll give you the Reader's Digest today. We're on page R113, I think starting on section 46. I think all the members should have maybe heard this issue. I know the Senate did. Senator Rosen had it in amended to her bill. And the House members, this was a junkie bill last year. And I think all of you were on environment last year, so you would have heard this. Anyway, the brief story. Back in 98, in this very room, we had a big feedlot discussion starting in that year. And in that year, we had a provision put in that required feedlots over 1,000 animal units to get NPDES permits. Those are National Pollution Discharge Elimination Permits. They're issued by the PCA, and it's pursuant to the Clean Water Act. If you have a discharge and you're going to put stuff in the water, you have to get a permit. Anyway, the law came in 98 and said, if you're over 1,000, you have to get one. And we said, but we don't discharge. The agency and some of the other groups advocating said, we don't care. You're over 1,000 animal, and it's your point source. And because you're a point source, you have to get a permit. And we said, we don't discharge. And they said, well, the feds are moving in that direction, so let's just get ahead of the curve. And that went in 98. Well, the feds didn't get ahead of the curve until 2003. They finally put out a rule similar to what Minnesota had. There was a lawsuit. It was consolidated in 2005. The ag group said you're going too far. The environmental group said you're not going far enough. So they went back to the drawing board. And in 2008, another rule came out. That rule said if you propose to discharge, you have to get them. It wasn't determined on whether you were 1,000 or more. It was if you proposed to discharge. And there was another lawsuit over that. The farm group said, we think it has to be an actual discharge. There was a court ruling a couple of weeks ago on March 15th affirming that. It was down in the Fifth Circuit. There has to be an actual discharge for the PCA to regulate the pollutant that would go in the water. Well, of course, on livestock farms, we have a zero discharge standard. We don't discharge. And so here we are buying these permits, these discharge permits, and we don't discharge. So language in front of you is a little bit longer than probably what we need. Mr. Schoenfeld will go through that with you, but that's the story on why we're here this afternoon.
I'm sorry, Mr. Klavan, were you done?
Yeah.
Questions for Mr. Klavan. Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, just point out that...
If you could identify yourself for
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Pork Producers. As Mr. Klavan had indicated, this bill actually follows up kind of along the same vein as what you did with House File 1, which was to say that if the federal government doesn't require it, then Minnesota shouldn't necessarily be going beyond that. On these permitting actions for streamlining permits. As Mr. Klavan had indicated, the federal court decision has now come down, says the EPA cannot do this unless you do discharge. There still would be some NPDES permits that would be issued because there are some feedlot situations, particularly dairies that may have discharge from a milk house or something like that, that still might need an NPDES permit. But basically, if we do not discharge, then we do not require a federal permit. Under the federal court decision, under what EPA will be now doing and that we are asking the state to follow. There are some advantages to this from our standpoint, too. First of all, by doing it, by eliminating this requirement to get a federal NPDES permit, we think that we'll be in a better position to deal with the state when permits are reissued. To deal with the state of Minnesota rather than it's more difficult to deal with some of the federal rule changes and so forth. Secondly, we think it is the proper permit as the court has determined that it's the proper permit, the fact that we don't need it if we don't discharge. And thirdly, the fact that presently with an NPDES permit, over 1,000 animal units is required by the state law here, we can't run those permits and deal with the local authorities at the county level, the county feedlot officers. They must be done through the state. And so it's not a delegated authority. So we think that's one other advantage that we would be able to have our farmers work with the county feedlot officers as all those under 1,000 animal units do. So that's another advantage. I don't want you to get the idea, however, that if this is gone, that somehow feedlots are not regulated. That simply is not the case. Presently with me, if you take a look at this, this is the 70-20 rules. There's 68 pages of regulations in there. And there are other places in our statutes that also regulate feedlots. And I would just point out some of them. For instance, if you're over 1,000...
Mr. Schoenfeld, remember, yes. We're on the Reader's Digest.
Reader's Digest, Mr. Yeah. Chairman. Then I will do the Reader's Digest, and I'm going to show you a page of 28 pieces of... other regulations that we need to deal, including EAWs and other kinds of things. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I will stop with the Reader's Digest version.
Any questions for the testifiers? Thank you both. Appreciate you coming.
Thank you, Chairman, members.
Next, we have Montana Picard. Are you in the audience? You could come forward, identify yourself for the record, give us your testimony.
My name is Montana Picard, and I'm here addressing the wild rice, the water standards. I'm here today on behalf of the group Protect Our Monoman. Monoman is the Ojibwe Anishinaabe word for wild rice.
Thank you.
The Anishinaabe relationship with their Monoman is intimate, integral, and sacred. Monoman is to the Anishinaabe what buffalo is to the Lakota. The Ojibwe people have lived in what is now Minnesota for millennia and have harvested the wild rice for hundreds of years. Birds, insects, ducks, and people, as well as fish, reptiles, and small unseen life, all live on and depend on wild rice for food and shelter. Wild rice is a barometer of a healthy, vibrant ecosystem. However, in areas across Wisconsin and Michigan, where sulfite runoff from mining is present, wild rice is dying off. European Americans have inhabited Minnesota for 153 years. In that time, they have taken most of the Ojibwe land by treaty. All the virgin forests have been cut down, the water has been polluted, and the environment has changed in the name of progress and profit. But now, with so little forest and wetland left, you must stop and ask yourselves, why do I live here? Do I live in Minnesota so I can complain about the cold? Or do I live here for the beauty of it, the lakes, the rivers, and the seasons? Do you fish, hunt, hike, ski in the North Woods? Do you love our North Shore, our boundary waters? If you do, then why would you vote to turn it over to a foreign company that would ultimately destroy what is left of our environment for their profit? I understand that people need jobs, but these jobs are short-lived and come with a heavy price tag. The money made in royalties and taxes will never pay for the amount of destruction brought by these companies, and they will leave the mess for us here to live with, to pay for and to get sick on. Wild rice beds will not survive an increase of sulfate levels in the water where they live. This has been proven by science and by the oral history of the Anishinaabe. For the Ojibwe, losing this vital food source through sulfite mining amounts to ecocide. Destroying the Monoman is destruction of their culture and their spirituality. Even if my values seem different than yours, I have voted for you to be here and represent my interests and Minnesota's interests. I ask you to stop putting multinational industry profits before our environment. There are better ways to solve our problems we face. If you allow these companies to destroy our land and waters, in turn our Monoman, it will be permanent. I ask you, would you trade your home, your food, and your family's health for a short-term job that paid so very much less than what your life was worth? Last, I want to say Native people live in every district in this state, and you do represent them. We are, after all, first and last people in Minnesotans. Please do not allow further destruction of our environment. Thank you, Miigwech.
Questions for Ms. Picard? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to remind the rest of the testifiers that it's great if you're willing to give us the handout, but you don't need to read the entire handout. Thank you, and I didn't mention that to you, but that's been a policy of ours throughout the year in the committee, that if you give us the handout, we'd appreciate it. If you just hit the highlights, and then we can get just as much out of it, and it'll allow more time for more testifiers. I think next we have Mr. Hottinger from the Sierra Club. Senator, are you here? You are. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always a pleasure to testify to your committee, in this case, your conference committee. My name is John Hottinger, a former state legislator. I live in St. Paul, and I'm the immediate past chair of the Minnesota North Star chapter of the Sierra Club. I had 74 pages of testimony, but the chair has convinced me that might be too long. So I have honed it down
Senator,
to the Reader's Digest.
Senator, I'll listen to 74 pages if we're going to get a bridge built over the St. Croix.
But
completely separate issue. Senator, back to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, as a fiscal conservative, I can't imagine why you would be supporting a Cadillac bridge for $700 million more than a Viking stadium when we
Senator,
could do
back
it.
Back to the environment committee. Sorry I brought it up.
When we could do it more extensively.
We're going to work on that issue, Senator.
Okay, good. Thank you. In any case, I'll speak briefly, and I do mean briefly, as an overview of the bill, and then more specifically in the wild rice standards. Again, briefly. You know, there are always going to be legitimate disagreements between people who have different points of policy on direction on policy in Minnesota. That's okay. People from different perspectives and different backgrounds and different constituencies do have valid reasons for viewing things different. But much of environmental policy is based on science. And science isn't a belief system or an ideology. It's a method of evaluating information and arriving at conclusions based on factual evidence. Good environmental policy is based on that sound science, public input, and a careful balancing of interest. We have general concerns about the bill in that it limits state agencies to enact protections for the lakes and rivers, grants new industry exemptions from environmental review, and weakens permitting standards for big agriculture while imposing significant cuts on funding for water pollution. We would favor the governor's position that controversial policy provisions be excluded from this bill and dealt with additional public input and consideration. Moving on to the one, and interestingly, that reliance on sound science has long been a conservative point of view, that as we do environmental regulation, we should look to the science and not the ideology or the business interests separately, a conservative point of view. And likewise, even in this particular bill, as it relates to the standards for sulfides in wild rice, at least the Senate, and I think the House also, has wisely funded a study to come up with the best science-based number to use for that standard. Unfortunately, and here's where our concern comes in, the House bill puts a seemingly arbitrary standard up for the wild rice standards that's five times the current standard, which went through a scientific study as its basis, and the Senate eliminates it altogether. This seems like a very unwise approach to a policy decision on behalf of what level of sulfides should be used or should be permitted to wild rice, because wild rice is kind of a canary in the mine shaft. It's an indicator of damage that goes beyond wild rice, but it's just an indicator that there are problems with the sulfide emissions. So why we would eliminate that before the study, which you authorize and fund, or are likely to, since both the Senate and House do, seems like a bad policy direction and a bad policy choice. As I said, I appreciate the opportunity to appear in front of you, and I want to say that I understand the unique circumstances outlined by the past witness in terms of the role wild rice plays in Minnesota. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Hottinger? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we have Mr. Harnack. Welcome, Mr. Harnack.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ron Harnack. I'm project coordinator for the Red River Watershed Management Board. And I would like to thank the committees very much for their past and continued support for our Red River flood retention projects. It's been very helpful in making our permitting process efficiency through all the state agencies. Over the last 10 years, we have not had a single delay as a result of state permitting. I would also like to voice a couple concerns about the budget reductions to the water resources programs within DNR. It is our understanding that field operations permitting folks would be impacted by these reductions, and that could result in significant delays or denial of permits as we move forward. We've had significant successes with the agencies. They've been a great partner over the last 10 years that has changed past tradition where it's been more of a contentious relationship. So we appreciate your consideration of addressing the water resources permitting reductions in your bills and accommodate that as much as possible within your deliberations the next several days. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Harnack? Thank you, Mr. Harnack. Next, I have Jim Lilienthal. Jim Lilienthal? Not here. Okay. Mr. Plumbo is Mr. Pachia. Is it? As long as you're here, why don't we bring you forward? We've got two folks that were on the Commerce Department that were earlier on the list. And is Mr. Henderson? Did we do him, or are you all together? That's the three of you right there. One, two, three.
Yes,
you don't
Mr.
look
Chair.
Like Larry Moe and Curly, though. But anyway, welcome.
Close. Thank you.
If you could identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony, we'd like the Reader's Digest or the Cliff Notes. As if you're of an era of Mr. Palumbo and I, we would know Cliff Notes. Either yes. One. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dave Peach. I'm currently the Executive Director of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. And our testimony today will be reference page R38. Both the House and Senate bills take $1.5 million over the 2012 and 2013 biennium and transfer these resources to the general fund. And we're talking about the auto theft prevention program. The reduction will mean that there is less than $1.3 million, which is required by state statute in the next biennium, to be distributed in grants. The result in current grantees receiving less in the next biennium than they do now. In fact, the current solicitation from the Department of Commerce notices only $1.5 million for the entire biennium is available for grants, which is not consistent with the statute to distribute $1.3 million each year. The current solicitation therefore caps eligible grants and is not consistent with the notion that there are excess resources in this account. The net effect of this decrease will mean less resources to combat auto theft. The reductions are not just taking the surplus. In fact, many grant applications have been turned down. For example, in Dakota County was not funded at all. In Anoka County, where I'm a former police chief, I was part of the Anoka County grant, in which our experience had been over a 60% drop in auto thefts over a two-year period. There are also communities throughout the state that benefit from this grant. And this grant is a partnership with the insurance industry and law enforcement, and the benefits include training from the BCA to all communities throughout the state, and also activities by the State Patrol and several other agencies throughout the state of Minnesota that have also noticed and documented noteworthy successes. The idea of the surplus dollars appears to be inaccurate, as we have communities that did not have their grant requests funded at all, and others, including Anoka County, which were underfunded by thousands of dollars. With me today, Mr. Chair, is also Bob Henderson from the insurance industry.
Welcome, Mr. Henderson. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robert Henderson. I'm currently supervisory special agent for the National Insurance Crime Bureau. I'm also president of the Anti-Vehicle Crime Association of Minnesota. What I want to talk about today is the impact and the cooperation between the insurance industry and the participants in the grant program. We have a lot of success stories through the grant program. As an example, in 1997, we had in Minnesota over 17,000 stolen vehicles reported. Comparing that to 2009, 8,519. So we've seen a improvement, dramatic improvement, in the number of stolen vehicles going down. The successes that we see as far as from the insurance industry are many. With this grant program, for one example, the Minneapolis Police Department has a bait vehicle program. And with this program, from 1997 to 2007, they've had over 300 people charged with possession of stolen property or theft of a motor vehicle based upon this program. The insurance industry saw the benefit of this program. Currently, two insurance companies have donated vehicles to be used as bait vehicles by the police department, and the industry has also provided funding to help them with these activities. As president of AVCAM, we utilize the auto theft grant program for training. We provide training seminars to law enforcement and insurance investigators in the area of vehicle theft and vehicle crime. We also are providing a two-day vehicle theft investigation seminar for law enforcement that has been conducted throughout the state of Minnesota, both metro and outstate. Based upon the grant, we've been able to supplement the training with training videos, including a video of a former auto thief from St. Paul who agreed and participated in the training film and has been very successful in training law enforcement in the areas of auto theft. We recognize with auto theft that it's just not joyriding. It's not people taking cars. Auto theft has many crimes connected with it. There's retagging, where a stolen vehicle VIN number is changed with another VIN number to disguise the identity of the stolen vehicle. There's cloning, which is a new crime where a thief will take a VIN number, an actual VIN number off an actual vehicle, and make his own VIN plate and put it on a stolen vehicle. Thus, we end up with two vehicles with the same VIN number in two different locations, and one of these vehicles are stolen. We have the selling of parts where cars are stolen and chopped up and the parts are sold for money. We have stolen cars that are being used as donor vehicles to help rebuild salvage vehicles. Once the salvage vehicle is rebuilt, then they're able to sell it and obtain money in that endeavor. We also have, we've had cases where stolen vehicles have been actually sold to metal scrappers. Within hours after being stolen, the cars are taken to a metal scrapper and sold cash for the metal. There's also carjacking where we have violence used to steal vehicles. Usually an armed offender will take a vehicle by force using a gun, and that's something that we addressed in auto theft. Finally, from the insurance side, insurance fraud, approximately 10 to 12% of total stolen vehicles are not stolen vehicles, but in actuality it's insurance fraud. And based on that, we want to pursue those aggressively, the result being in keeping the insurance premium dollars down through effective enforcement of this crime. In addition, there are some others. The AVCAM has a media grant that has helped to get the word out to the public concerning auto theft, pocketing your key, locking your cars up. We do advertise a heat tip line, and that has been successful. We have received useful information on tips leading to recovery of stolen vehicles and apprehension of criminals. The license plate reader program is an instrument that law enforcement has started utilizing here in Minnesota, where a squad car or police vehicle, with this equipment, they're able to capture the license plate and at the same time check that license plate number for a stolen report. And that has been very successful. Both Minneapolis and St. Paul, Bloomington, and other law enforcement agencies have utilized this. The Minnesota State Patrol, through grant program, has been able to equip and train 30 troopers in the area of vehicle theft investigation. These troopers, once trained, are able to conduct a vehicle theft crime investigation. They're able to inspect and identify potentially stolen vehicles, and this program has been tremendously successful since its inception. Finally, funding has been provided for Anoka County for an auto theft task force. Officers from different agencies have combined. They meet. They are sharing information. They're assisting each other in combating vehicle theft in Anoka County. This program has been successful. Just for conclusion, on the insurance industry side, we see the tremendous benefit of this program. In addition, this benefit goes not only to insureds where their vehicles are insured when stolen, but also to people who don't have insurance, who cannot afford comprehensive insurance for their vehicles. They benefit from this program because if their vehicle is stolen and we have an opportunity to recover it, the law enforcement community will recover it, and it has been successful. So we want to encourage this program to remain, and hopefully you will continue with this program. Thank you.
Okay. Members, any questions? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tony Palumbo, P-A-L-U-M-B-O. I'm the Anoka County Attorney, and I certainly would echo what the previous two testifiers stated about the effectiveness of this particular program. As we see it, this is an investment by citizens in public safety. This is a charge that's put on their insurance bills. They pay for it. It is being used directly for the reason that it was put on that statement. It is a program that works, as you have heard spoken to by the previous two speakers. I can speak to Anoka County. In 2008, we had 727 vehicles stolen. And during this program, in the year 2010, that number was significantly reduced to 331 vehicles, well over a 60% reduction as a result of the efforts of this program. That still represents over $2 million in vehicle theft value, which is still way too high, but we're certainly working on the problem. In the county attorney's office, these funds are used in community outreach. We have brochures. We have a significant number of brochures that we hand out 2,000 to 3,000 a year at various programs throughout the year in Anoka County. These brochures and the community outreach efforts are instrumental in preventing crime. This is a program that prevents crime, as you've heard testified to earlier. This program is making a difference in people's lives. You know, if your car is stolen, and you know what I mean, and I know the chair has certainly been a victim of this in the past, he's well aware of what has occurred to him. We ask members of the committee that you keep the funds for their statutorily intended purpose. There was a reason why the statute was passed. It was to address a problem that occurred a while ago. That problem still remains, and it exists today. And it will only get worse if the funding is removed from this program. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Members, any questions? We never had this problem in Douglas County. This is all foreign. This is all foreign to me. I don't understand.
You're doing a great job then in Douglas County. I understand.
Well, it's gotten a little worse in the last 4 years. However, so any questions, members? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
I think we have next on the agenda, Mr. Eager. I'm sorry, Mr. Eager, is that right? Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Eager, Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors, representing the nearly 20,000 realtors throughout Minnesota. And I will be very brief. I did have an opportunity to testify in both the Senate and the House on this matter. It's also on the fund transfers that you can find in the side-by-side on page R38. Or in the spreadsheet on page 9. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify. We do have concerns about two specific fund transfers in the bill, and before I mention those, I just want to thank Senator Gerlach and Senator Dames at the first meeting in this conference committee did discuss their concerns about the fund transfers, and we had a good discussion, particularly on the Senate side, regarding those fund transfers, and that they were not an easy choice for the committee to make, and we appreciate that. However, on behalf of our members, we do have concerns with the fund transfers moving forward, and at the specific level that ultimately, if the conference committee includes fund transfers, that those dollars are set. And in particular for our members, they pay license fees when they get an initial license and when they renew their license every other year. And part of the fees that they pay for their licenses go towards the license technology surcharge account and also the real estate recovery fund. And as the committee moves forward and determines how they're going to meet their targets, we just want to encourage you to minimize, if not eliminate, those fund transfers if possible. There is quite a bit of difference, as you'll note in your spreadsheet, between the House and the Senate positions for these two specific funds. And one of the concerns that did come up in the Senate hearing, I think, is a cash flow concern. And in particular on the Real Estate Recovery Fund, Mr. Chairman, in statute, the Commissioner of Commerce has the authority to adjust or to assess a surcharge to maintain the fund balance at an adequate level. And if there is a fund transfer in the bill from this particular account, we want to make sure that Commerce is consulted, because the last thing we would want to see happen is transfer from this fund for a purpose other than its designated purpose, but the kicker being it would also result in an assessment of additional dollars on our licensees. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I know most of you are well aware of the concerns on fund transfers. You share those concerns, and we just would like to work with you to minimize the level of those fund transfers in the bill, if possible. And with that, Mr. Chairman, be happy to answer any questions.
Members, any questions? Thank you, Mr. Eggers.
Thank you very much.
Next we have on the agenda, unless I'm lost my track here, Lance Ness. Mr. Ness, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have a handout being passed out. For the record, I'm Lance Ness. I'm the president of Anglers for Habitat and Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. Today I'm also speaking for about 30 other conservation groups. in support of license structure increase. Just as you finalize your budget, we would a lot of organizations would like to address the issue of great importance to us. We advocate on behalf of some 2 million fishermen and 600,000 hunters that countless others who value our natural resources that we support a license increase at this time. And just the bottom line, Mr. Chairman, I'll keep it quick and simple. We love our lakes, we love our streams, we love our rivers, we love our wildlife and our fish, and we want to make sure it's passed on to another generation. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my testimony.
Members, any questions from Mr. Ness? Thank you very much. Next concerned citizen here, I have Tanya Hobbit. Welcome Hello. To the committee.
Welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Pull the microphone really close and identify yourself. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and committee, my name is Tanya Obid. Also, Buju, Bidwewe Yijagukwe Nandej Nakaz. Bakwa Manomanikam and Sanakwang and Dunjaba, Owasa Si Dudem. Igawateshkang Nindede Nigani Mama. Bungiatago Ninata Jaboemoin. Today I am speaking to you in my language. I have told you what my Indian name is and what my English name is. And I'm from the East Lake Band of East Lake Reservation, part of the Rice Lake Band of Ojibwe. I'm here to ask you to oppose the sulfide levels that are being put into our waters. And I'm here to also to ask you to protect our manomen, which is our wild rice. I would like to quote from the Seattle Declaration of the third ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization that was held on November 30th to December 3rd, 1999. And in some of these excerpts that I have outlined, mining laws in many countries are being changed to allow free entry of foreign mining corporations to enable them to buy and own mineral lands and to freely displace indigenous peoples from their ancestral territories. These large-scale commercial mining and oil extraction activities continue to degrade our lands and fragile ecosystems and pollute the soil, water, and air in our communities. Indigenous people should be equal participants in establishing the criteria and indicators for these analyses so that they take into consideration spiritual as well as cultural aspects. With regard to the liberalization of services and investments, we recommend the following. It must stop unsustainable mining, commercial planting of monocrops, dam construction, oil exploration, land conversion to golf clubs, logging, and other activities which destroy indigenous peoples' lands and violate the rights of indigenous peoples to their territories and resources. The right of indigenous peoples to their traditional lifestyles, cultural norms and values should likewise be recognized and protected. And this is something that I would like to see that would go out on the global scale, not only with just within Minnesota, because this is the beautiful land that we, through our own oral histories, have been told to be able to protect and be able to have our grandchildren. For I am a grandmother, and I would like to see that these crops, the wild rice and the waters and the animals and the inhabitants, that which is our inherent right to be able to gather, fish, and hunt. With that, miigwech.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Next, Susan Lynn. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Susan Lynn, and I am here today on behalf of, in regards of the Water Legacy Act and plans of sulfide mining, threat of our manumen. I understand that most of you in this room, unless you are fighting the issue to save our waters from sulfide contamination, you most likely have been convinced of the idea that sulfide mining is a necessary component of industrial activity for the sake of job creation and the demand for precious metals. Sulfide mining is not a necessary component of industrial activity for either the need of industry jobs, or for the need of precious metals. We need to initiate large-scale clean energy plans to bring the jobs to Minnesota. We need to put the monies appropriated for sulfide mining into recycling. We can't begin to assess whether we have enough metals ready for reuse until we establish efficiency in the recycling of our state. Minnesota has 10 more garbage burners than the average state in the United States. We likely already have a good portion of the metals that we need ready for reuse, if not all that we need, in fact, shipped into Minnesota from other states in the form of garbage, salvage, and refuse. These two issues of job creation from needed and publicly demanded green and clean energy and proper recycling could and should cancel out the need for sulfide mining. Mining should not happen in Minnesota. Minnesota is a water state. Mining sites designated for the edge of the boundary water exist in the wetlands of northern Minnesota. I enjoyed canoeing in the boundary waters as a child, as many of you probably have. This will be changed. This would be changed in our lifetimes and in our children's lifetimes. Sulfide levels have been shown to kill life forms when above 5 parts per million. We eventually kill ourselves by poisoning our water. If we ignore these indicators, if we contaminate our waters with acid levels, which kill life forms and our manumen, the wild rice treasure of Minnesota, we contaminate the health of wildlife, we contaminate our health. These are not consumable resources. Our lives are not consumable. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the testifier? Next, Ms. Mushko. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, honorable senators and House members. My name is Opechi Mushkub. I'm from East Lake, Minnesota. I'm also a ricer, and I'm representing my children who are going to be the future ricers. And I'm coming from this community. It's one of the oldest ricing communities in Minnesota, and we have also been very fortunate that where we harvest rice, it is also a national wildlife refuge. So our rice is one of the last places in Minnesota where there's no motorized boats on this lake. And I'm concerned about the wild rice water quality standards because it's going to affect our rice and our children in this water. I eat rice every day, and so do my children. And I drink water. My children drink water too. And this is where our rice grows. To our people, it was called Manomen, a sacred gift, you know, the sacred berry. It grows on the water. And we need to oppose these standards because anything that's done to that water, it's going to affect my children. And I'm speaking to you today on behalf of these children because my son has started picking rice also. And he's out there today, yesterday, and the day before. He's out there on the water, and he's practicing his treaty rights that we've reserved here. We harvest fish, and he's out there, and he's getting those fish. This young man is 14 years old. He's providing for his family. And during this recession, that's all we have is our water, our rice, our fish, our berries. Now, if we increase these sulfide standards, we're going to be poisoning our children and our children's children. And this is all we have. My son, you know, we haven't been doing so good. We have to pay to go out there and pick this rice, to go out there and get those fish. And during this time, it's been hard on all of us. We haven't been able to get out there and do these things because we've been suffering. We've had to borrow money to go out there and practice these rites, to be able to pick this rice, to be able to harvest these fish, and to gather. Now, there's a lot of people out there that are suffering like me. You know, not only Native people, but non-Indian people. And I'm sure each and every one of us here has children, grandchildren, nieces and nephews that like to drink clean water, that like to eat fish, that like to eat rice. When I cook these things for my children, they eat everything they can. And you don't know how many times that I've had to go hungry to feed these kids. And that's all I have is my rice and our water. So I'm asking you, please, do not increase these sulfide levels in the water, because it's our children that we need to protect and the water. So thank you, honorable members, please. Think of our children and our water quality standards. Miigwech.
Thank you very much.
Is there any questions you'd like to ask me?
Yes, are there any questions from the members? First, we want to thank you for coming. Can you just give me a little geographic as to where, you said you where you were from. Is it the northeast part of the state?
I'm from central Minnesota.
North central?
Yes. If you know where the Rice Lake National Wildlife Refuge is, I live right across the street from there.
Okay.
And like I said, you know, this is one of the oldest ricing communities in the state. We still go there every year and harvest.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, Karen McCall. Not seeing Karen McCall. Brenda Adams. Sheila Vanney. Or is it Vaney? Soil and Water District. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Sheila Vanney, and I'm the Assistant Director with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. I do have a letter that I submitted in advance, and I'm not sure if that made it into the members' packets, but I will give you the Cliff Notes version of that letter. On behalf of our member soil and water conservation districts, we have three primary concerns with the omnibus bill that you're considering. One is the SWCD service grants. Soil and water conservation districts are the boots on the ground working to get conservation programs implemented with landowners. Thank you. So that infrastructure is diminishing with cuts to local government aid, as SWCDs receive about a third of their budget from the county, a third from the state, and a third self-generated through grants and federal partnerships. The state portion of that is about $20-some thousand, and a good part of that goes to fund staffing. We need those SWCD technical staff in order to get the programs implemented. Or you can present all of the program dollars in the world and they just won't get implemented. Our other concern is with the natural resource block grant cuts. Again, a good portion of those go to the soil and water conservation districts, and we need that technical capacity in order to get those programs implemented. Our third concern is with the Board of Water and Soil Resources budget itself. There's serious cuts to the staffing capabilities within that agency. and that's going to seriously diminish their ability to provide assistance and services to their local government clientele, of which SWCDs are a part. So the cuts in this bill, in addition to the cuts that are before you in other bills, are seriously going to hamper the ability of the Board of Water and Soil Resources to deliver its services. With that, I'd stand for any questions.
Members, any questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Maybe you've already covered this, but could I go back to the wild rice water quality standard? Apparently there's a standard in the House and not...
Can you give us a page reference? I'm sorry.
R57.
I'm sorry?
R57.
R57, members.
If council or somebody could just refresh our memory on the differences there.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the important part to look at, if you're talking about just the standards portion of this, you'll see Section 19 on the House side proposes a standard of 50 milligrams per liter or 50 parts per million, and whereas the Senate, instead of providing a standard, basically suspends the current standard of 10 parts per million in the current rule of the agency until the new rules are completed in paragraph E. So basically, it's the Senate, instead of providing a standard like the House, just says that we're going to suspend the standard during the time while we're going through this study and rulemaking part.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair. And Mr. Knopf, when is this study to be completed?
Well, Mr. Knopf. Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, as I understand it, it could take a few years to do the study. But what the Senate did is just tied into to completing all of the rulemaking, the study and rulemaking. But you'll see that there's money in here and in the legacy bill to complete the study. But it doesn't really have a specific date on when. There's a first rulemaking that's on the Senate side and also on the House side, but that's not the rulemaking we're talking about. That's supposed to be to establish a standard in a hurry in paragraph A. But the remainder of it is they're going to have to, I think the agency, if I remember right, it was 3 to 4 years. I don't remember the exact timeline on this.
I actually think it was even less than that, at the very least 2 years. Senator Rosa, too, just for your information, there's been a lot of discussion. We've had a lot of discussion in this committee and as you can imagine. So these standards are from, and help me out to your members, if you remember, some 1940s, and then I think it was 1973 was the last standard that we've been living off of, if you will. That's the standard from 1973. So, just to give you a little idea, and it's different. Just because I'm going to throw this number out doesn't mean it is, doesn't mean anything other than right now the drinking water standards are 250 parts per million. So, but that doesn't matter. We're not talking about us drinking, and we're talking about growing plant life. Any further questions? With that, members, on the schedule, we've talked about, we're talking about discussing and adopting the same and similar section, so we'll let Mr. Knopf move into that, if that's all right, and after that short time, he's telling me it shouldn't take too long, we'll do a little recess. So Mr. Knopf, do
Mr.
we have
Chair
this stuff
and in members, you should have a in your packet, you should have had a copy of a side-by-side that staff have worked on. I think we have a few sames in here. You could do it all in one motion. But if you see on basically page R42 and 43, there are two same provisions, one on the removing the 25,000 cap on appropriations from the State Park Working Capital account, and then the Forest Management Investment Account cost certification. Those are the same on both sides. Again, we're not going over riders that are the same. We can do that after the money is solved, because there many of them have a dollar amount attached to them. And if you go to the next page of the comparison, you can see the water fees to the water management account on R47 to 49 is the same. And then also the electronic waste registration fees on R50 through R-54, the Petro Fund eligibility in R-54 and 55, and the Petro Fund extension in R-55. If you wanted to, you could adopt all of those provisions as one motion, unless there are concerns.
Members, what's your wishes? I'm seeing another couple pages here. I don't see any same Mr. Knopf, so I want.
Mr. Chairman, let me just be clear. These are the policy sames. There are riders within the LCCMR and within the other articles of the bill that are the same, but we're not talking about those at this point in time. Yeah. All the ones listed are the same.
Any discussion on feelings of the members about adopting or not? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to be clear on one of the points on the commerce section, and I don't know, trying to follow along here, but there's one piece that we are the same on, but I want to hold off on that for further discussion, and we heard some testimony on that, and that was the auto theft prevention account. And I know that we have the same on that.
I'm sorry, Mr. Knopf has a clarity.
Well, Mr. Chair, this wouldn't include that part. This is only the Petro Fund. I don't know if you wanted to. This is the extension for 5 years, and then the.
But I'm good. I just wanted.
And then the eligibility.
That's what I wanted to make sure I wasn't missing something, because although those were the other same on the adult theft prevention, I wanted to leave that open for some possible other additional discussion. Yeah. So I didn't want to just adopt that piece.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gerlach, anything that affects the general fund financing would not be included at this point in time.
Okay. Yeah. Then I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions about the. The adoption of the same. There's a total of 1, 2, 7. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I would move we adopt the sames that are on our sheet here.
Motion's been made by Senator Dames to adopt the sames on the document before you. Any further discussion?
Right there.
Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
And Mr. Chair, you've got a couple of similar items. If we could do those, I think you could do those fairly quickly. In the walkthrough, I explain the differences in the water management account. It starts on page R-47. And again, this was a recommendation of the administration, and there was some later language that was not part of the original bill that the Senate picked up. That broadens and clarifies what the money can be used for. And I think if you adopted the Senate language on both of those similar items, on the on section 39 on the Senate and 41 on the Senate, I think you could take care of those without too much trouble. I don't know unless somebody else has an objection to that, but I think the way the Senate has done this, it works the best.
Members, any questions, any concerns?
No.
Hearing none, would somebody make that motion? Make that into a motion?
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Rosen.
Senator Rosen moves that we adopt those two sections. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Good. Motion carried. Anything else?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think that's it for the same and similars of policy.
Okay. Members, as I said, we're going to have a little recess. However, we got one more testifier that. The grace of the room, and he'd like to talk. Mr. Botzik has a tendency to talk along, but we're gonna cut him off. So we're getting kind of hungry. So you have that to have to worry about. Mr. Botzik, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I will be brief. I'm getting hungry too, hearing all about the great hunting and fishing and wild rice opportunities we have in Minnesota. I do have a handout, Mr. Chairman. I'm Gary Botzik. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. I'd like to thank both chairs for allowing Steve Morris, our executive director, myself, and a number of our partners, over 80 to 90 environment conservation groups that testified throughout the session. You've got a very difficult task in front of you, and we want to help you and encourage you on. Historically, our environmental conservation budget has averaged about 1% of the general fund. And that's all you've got to work with. When your friends down the hall have got education bills and health and human services bills that are running hundred millions of dollars compared to the nickel and dimes you have to work with. It's very difficult to get that done. But we encourage you to stand your ground and bring more money to your committee, to your conference committee. With that, Mr. Chairman, the cuts in general fund this year are heavy in water, Eco Service Water Department's division at the Natural Resources Department because of that heavy general fund exposure. We would hope that that could be minimized to the best degree possible. Mr. Chairman, we'd also strongly encourage that some of the policy bills that are in the legislation, particularly in the Senate bill, be set aside and moved into an omnibus policy bill for further discussion. Those would include the water moratorium and the water study, the Mississippi River Corridor critical area repealer, the ethanol, large ethanol mandatory environmental review, as well as the feedlot language and the sulfide pollution standard changes that were just described in both the House and the Senate bill. And lastly, in policy, there is the phosphorus discharge standard in Lake Pepin. We feel those, Mr. Chairman, need further discussion and debate and should be removed from this bill. Then finally, Mr. Chairman, we support the hunting and fishing license fee that Mr. Lance addressed. We think that maybe there's an option to get some additional revenue into your bill, either into these agencies through an increase in the hunting and fishing license fees. We'd also like to add, and this is what the handout is all about, this just got finalized today, and this relates to support for the boating license surcharge that the governor has proposed to help with AIS, aquatic invasive species. We'd like to thank both the committees, both House and Senate, for putting in their bills major increases in the AIS program. We think that LCCMR funding is short-term, and we need a long-term solution and a long-term program. We think that could come from a user fee. The current surcharge, as you know, for a three-year boat license is $5. The governor, through his proposal, has suggested increasing that to as high as $20 for some boats over a three-year period. We think that deserves some attention and support, and we think that would help bring your conference committee together, either with this language in your bill or supplemental bills elsewhere in the process. And Mr. Chairman, this letter was just finalized this morning. There are over 53 organizations, lake associations, hunting and fishing groups signed on, and this is all in support. So it's brand new and hot off the press, and we just like to bring it to your attention and encourage you to give it thorough review. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would
any questions,
stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Botzing. Any questions for Mr. Botzing?
Thank you.
Members, what you should know, just for those members, Mr. Botzing, if you just stay there for a second, we'll know that we've been grappling with this fee thing and talking about this invasive species all year, basically. And the House and the Senate have certainly been spending a lot of time on that, and we've been talking about funding, and the funding mechanism that we have right now is, and I do agree, is one-time funding. I think the whole committee can agree with that, coming from the from LCCMR funding, and through a lot of pains that actually made it into this bill, and because those folks have done a lot of work over the last 2 years to come up with a bill, but we thought it was more important to deal with these emerging situations without having to raise fees. So generally where the invasive species fees, or excuse me, funding comes from is, and Mr. Butzik's right, from a portion of the boat fees as well as the out-of-state license fees. And there's certainly been some talk, not real loud, but about raising those fees as well as hunting and fishing fees. And that of course, is something that we're looking down the line. My question to you, Mr. Botzik, is what is your knowledge of the fees that the DNR has set aside right now that are still in the Game and Fish Fund? Do you know what the balance is,
Mr. Chairman? I don't know the actual balance. I know that the hunting side of the ledger is in better shape, and this teeter totter. The angling license fees to the Game and Fish Fund are going to go in the red sooner than the hunting. In fact, may already be there. Staff Knopf can correct me. He knows these numbers. But the whole fund, Game and Fish Fund, is, I believe, destined to go in the red in its entirety in about 2013 or 14, I believe, maybe 14. So we need a ramp up in those things, because if you increase license fees, just in whether they're on boats or whether they're on individual hunting or fishing licenses, it takes time, and that has to be kicked in at the appropriate time, whether it's March 1st or other start dates as it relates to certain hunting seasons, et cetera. So you're not going to be getting the full impact of that revenue to the agencies for at least a year. So we historically have tried to bump that or jumpstart that in advance and not running those funds that close to the red line, if you will, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Botzik? Members, I'm sorry I lied to you. What we've discussed here with the other chair is that we're going to go for an hour, try and get through the LCCMR funding portion of the bill, and that will probably be it for the night. So if we could do that, that's workable. We'll move into that section right now.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hopp.
Mr. Chair, I think that's an excellent decision. I know how quickly traditionally how quickly the LCCMR folks talk, so I think that's
very good. Decision. Good. Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
You can't leave.
Mr. Reinholtz, if I could ask you, when we went through the differences in the spreadsheets, did we do the individual line items on the LCCMR?
Mr. Chairman, we went through the we did go through the you're talking about the side by side, or are you talking about the spreadsheet?
The spreadsheet with the individual projects?
Mr. Chair, yes, I did go through the spreadsheet by project, individual project.
Okay, Mr. Reinholtz, is Ms. Thornton here? Why don't you come up to the testifier table? And I see you have Mrs. Gibson with you, too. Ms. Gibson, if you could come forward, and specifically, we are going to want to take let the audience know there's going to be some different ones. We're going to deal with ones that are different between the House and Senate position. If you could identify yourself for the record, Ms. Thornton.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Susan Thornton. I am the director of the LCCMR Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources.
Welcome, Director. Ms. Gibson, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to testify and help any way I can. My name is Nancy Gibson, and I am the co-chair of the LCCMR.
Thank you. Ms. Thornton, why don't you begin to walk through? And I think what we'll do as we get to the first one I have, Mr. Arnosti, before you leave, or if you're going to get your recruits or reinforcements, excuse me, I believe the Minnesota Breeding Bird Atlas is the first one that has a difference on my spreadsheet as we work from top to bottom with the difference between the House and Senate.
Bird Atlas.
And I'm thinking, Ms. Thornton, we're only going to concentrate on ones that have differences. For instance, I've got the Bird Atlas, then I've got a Golden Eagle Survey, and then I think it's the Boreal Forest are the first three I see in the order that the sheet I'm working off of. And Ms. Thornton, if you could give us the Breeding Bird Atlas, and then anyone that has testimony for or against that issue, we'll do it that way. Ms. Thornton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the project labeled Minnesota Breeding Bird Atlas Phase 3 was originally recommended by the LCCMR to the Audubon, Minnesota, and NRRI at University of Minnesota, Duluth. And the House does not have that in it. The Senate has it in at $142,000 for the biennium. It was at approximately $330,000 as recommended from the commission going to the legislature. The Breeding Bird Atlas is the third phase of the Atlas. Minnesota is one of six states in the country that does not have this. It's baseline information and data using a lot of volunteers, and it's used for habitat conservation and restoration efforts. That's the thumbnail sketch.
Thank you. And is there, did you just do the Bird Atlas one, Ms. Thornton?
Mr. Chair, members, yes.
Mr. Anasti, on the Bird Atlas, do you want to speak to it? If you could come forward and give us your short testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members of the conference committee, my name is Don Arnosti. I'm the policy director for Audubon, Minnesota. The Breeding Bird Atlas, as was indicated, is a coalition partner project. I do have a little fact sheet if people would like to distribute that to the committee. Some of you might have seen this before. Fundamentally, this is a natural resource inventory of one of our critical natural resources here in the state. It's a citizen volunteer-led effort. Presently, I went on the site yesterday. There's a online live site where volunteers and citizens report their observations, and it's done in a scientifically controlled manner. 847 people are volunteering on this project at this point in time. We've documented over 15,000 volunteer hours already committed to the project with two cycles of funding invested. We think it's very important and urge the committee to provide at least partial funding as the Senate has provided, if not more, if possible, to conclude this project. I'll stand for any questions. If people have any questions, the fact sheet here provides you some further information.
Thank you, Mr. Anasti. Any additional testimony on the Bird Atlas? Next, Ms. Thornton, if you could go to the next one, I believe
Mr.
it's the
Chair.
Goal.
Mr. Chair, before you go ahead, could you tell us how many dollars have already been spent on this Atlas?
Mr. Anasti, I believe it's been through two different cycles of LCCMR.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Doms, not spent but allocated or appropriated already is $642,000 in LCCMR funding. There's also been additional, so not all of that funding has been spent because there is still one more year to run with the current appropriation. So I don't know precisely where we stand on the spending, but $642,000 is committed. There's also been contributions to the tune of $70,000 from the Minnesota Ornithological Union, which is one of the partner organizations. That's twice their annual budget that they've contributed as a nonprofit organization. Audubon as well has contributed. I don't know the exact number in terms of matching contributions of staff time and other things. The Fish and Wildlife Service has put money into it. We're probably talking about over $800,000 that have been allocated for the project to run through next year at this point.
Mr. Chairman,
thank
follow
you.
Up.
What's Senator Dames?
What's the projected total cost for this project?
Mr. Anasti.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Dames. The request to close out the project was the $330,000 that was originally recommended by LCCMR. That would conclude it. Including state amount, the state or the LCCMR contribution then would be $972,000, I believe, over a course of 5 years in funding. This is a baseline atlas that, as was indicated, almost every other state in the nation has and is used for wildlife conservation and management purposes, something that Minnesota is 20 years behind in getting.
Thank you. Ms. Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add that as a procedure and process at the LCCMR, we try to allocate money for projects, and we also try to invest in them. And we knew that this was going to be an investment of three different allocations, and I urge you to support it because we like to start projects and we like to finish them. And this is one project for game and non-game birds that's very, very critical to Minnesota.
Thank you. Ms. Thornton, if you could move next to the Golden Eagle Survey.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. The Golden Eagle Survey is a proposal for the National Eagle Center in Wabasha. And the House has it at $90,000, and the Senate does not have it in its spreadsheet. The Commission had recommended it at that same $90,000 as is on the House.
Thank you. Questions? The next one I have, Ms. Thornton, is the Boreal Forest one.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the Boreal Forest, again, it's a Commission recommendation of $200,000, House appropriation at $200,000. And this one really looks at the potential response of our northern Minnesota's coniferous forests to understanding how varying precipitation temperatures could impact more than 2 million acres of those lands. The conifers are not regenerated in historic rates, and this will help us understand that.
Question on the boreal forest. Next one I have, Ms. Thornton, is the St. Croix Basin Conservation Planning and Protection.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is St. Croix River Association, and the Commission recommended it at $200,000. The Senate put it in at a reduced amount at $120,000. It's to help essentially prioritize on-the-ground and coordinated activities in the St. Croix River Basin by its local, state, federal government and nonprofit units. So really identifying those areas critical for conservation so we can couple together those efforts.
Thank you, Ms. Thornton. Our original thoughts were we were not going to deal with Subdivision 4, and I, for a minute I did see Deputy Commissioner Shad with these pillars. I can't tell, but I don't believe he's in the room. Okay, we're fine, and we originally hadn't planned on that, and I don't think time's going to allow. The next one, Ms. Thornton, to confirm that we're still on the same page, I think we go all the way out. Item 6C, is that the next one you have? Ms. Thornton, the next one I have is Emerald Ash Borer Landscape Management Impacts.
Mr. Chairman, yes, you are correct. 6C is the next one, and the Commission had recommended it at $340,000. The Senate has it in at $229,000. This is a research project to assess the impacts of insecticides used for managing EAB, emerald ash borer, on water quality and other non-targeted insects, other pollinators.
Is there any questions on the emerald ash one by any of the members? Next, Ms. Thornton. I think we only have about three more, Ms. Thornton, that were questions on. There's the next one I have, Ms. Thornton, is the aquatic invasive species documentary that was not in either one, but the Senate has. Could you explain that one? Or you maybe don't know that.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that's a Senate position.
And it's $100,000 for Minnesota Public Television about aquatic invasive species. And then the last one is a House position on accelerated land sales in exchange. We had funded $200,000, and it was for the DNR to come back on that. And I guess on those last two, is there anybody in the public that wanted to speak for or against them?
Members, we're going to take a 5-minute recess.